This is HPR episode 1962 entitled, HPR New Year's Show episode 2. It is hosted by HPR volunteers, and is about 200 minutes long. The summary is, distros, wearable, distros, RIP Ian Murdoch, Chromebooks, Samsung, WW1, Libra Planet, TTS, and more.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Oh, and I reckon it's time we need to say Happy New Year to Afghanistan. So which distro is your preferred?
Right now I'm running Kubuntu on my stuff just because it's simple to throw on there. I don't have a lot of time usually to dick around with stuff. So,
you know, it's funny. The thing I don't like about Debian-based distros is I'm not really fond of Debian packaging. It just seems like RPM you can do a lot more and just actually building the packages. Well, going in and doing a make deb-dash package might seem easy on the surface. I don't think it really leads to entirely reproducible builds like you can get with RPM.
I'm not on that end of things, so I'm not real concerned with it.
I will say that I like the way that Debian handles networking over the way that Fedora and Red Hat handles networking.
In what way?
It's all just in one file, so you don't have to jump around and look everywhere. You can just open up one file and edit that one file, and you're done.
What about rccomp?
Well, let me rephrase it. The way I've seen it done, it's all in one file.
Yeah, it should be a file called etc network, isn't it?
Indeed.
Where does the Fedora throw it?
Etc sysconfig network-scripts, and then you have a different network script for every network device.
That sounds mildly confusing.
Hence my saying I prefer the way that Debian does it.
I'm looking at my current Kubuntu install. It's 15.10 on my laptop. I've got an earlier version on my desktop because of my AMD card. It doesn't look like the network is one specific file. Looks like we've got a bunch of them.
I haven't played as much with Ubuntu as I have with Debian and Triskel, but at least Debian and Triskel, well, of course, Triskel is kind of an Ubuntu derivative, so now I'm slightly confused.
It could be because of the systemd BS they've thrown in here, I'm not sure.
Ahoy, Urugami!
I've got an etc network directory, and then there's ifdown.d, ifpostdown.d, ifpreup.d, .d interfaces.d and a run. I'm not sure what run is, but
it would be, so the actual configuration would be in the etc network.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that etc network is actually a directory, it's not a file.
Okay, and well, what do you have within that directory?
There's subdirectories, ifdown.d, ifpostdown.d, ifpreup.d, ifup.d, a file named interfaces. Another directory called interfaces.d and run, which looks like an executable file. I'm not sure.
It would be the interfaces file. If you open that up, you would see your basic network config.
Now, am I correct in assuming that you were working on the ARM version of Fedora?
Yes.
Did you do any Pi stuff, or mostly just with, I think I heard you say Chromebooks?
I did a lot of work with Chromebooks for a while there, until I dropped my Chromebook and kind of busted it.
Well, that'll put a little damper on stuff.
But for various reasons, namely, the upstream kernel doesn't work on the Raspberry Pi, Fedora doesn't support it, and Fedora won't support it as long as the Raspberry Pi doesn't support the upstream kernel.
What about the distro Pydora?
That's actually done by Seneca College, which is up in Canada. They do it as their own thing.
I did not know that.
Mine, it's built off of Fedora, and with the newer Pis that are based on ARMv7 chips, they actually use the Fedora user space, but they still ship their own kernel.
Now, do you use any of the microcomputers?
How do you mean?
Raspberry Pi, Banana Pi, Arduino. I recently found one called PCduino.
I have an Arduino.
What do you use it for?
One second, guys.
Hey, guys. What's up? I'm back.
Hey, Taj.
Did I miss anything super cool?
Yes, lots.
Damn it.
I'm not going to repeat it. You're going to have to go back and listen to it later.
Well, that was going to happen anyways, so I guess no harm, no foul.
What about you, Taj? Do you have any of the single board computers?
The only thing that I've played with substantially is the Raspberry Pi, and I've played with pretty much every single one of them, besides the Pi Zero, and that's only because I can't get one right now. If I had one, I'm sure I would be doing things with it. To be honest, most of the stuff I do, I can do with Arduino, so for me, a lot of the times, I don't see the need for the single board computers, because I can just, if I'm going to put a computer that small with something, it probably doesn't need to do that much, so I usually just go with Arduinos, because they're easy to program, and they're cheap, and I can make them myself. I don't have to go anywhere to get them.
Sorry about that, y'all, I'm back. So, actually, the project I've been working on with an Arduino is making a one-handed QWERTY keyboard.
Really?
That sounds cool.
I have four keys, and eventually the idea is to have them embedded in the palm of a glove, and so I can just type one-handed and be able to have it connected somehow to a device. I'm not sure how I'm going to do that yet, and I figure that my ability to use touchscreen keyboards is rather lacking, so I figure this would be physically easier for me.
For exactly the same reason I thought about trying to come up with some sort of way to do, like, Morse code in a tactile way, because I hate on-screen keyboards. Just some way to be able to input things pretty quickly without having to deal with that. So, I like your idea.
Well, the plan is, once I get it functioning really well and get all the kinks worked out, I'm going to release all the source code and release an instruction set to kind of tell how to put it together. I guess this is motivation to work on it.
Well, I would definitely be down for trying it out if it was out there. So, yeah, if for no other reason than for me to play with it. Yeah, go ahead. Get it done.
Actually, what I've been thinking about doing is I've got a 64-bit ARM board on the way. It's a small one. And if I get hands on a some sort of small display, I could strap onto my forearm. I could definitely do some wearable computing.
I know Adafruit's got a bunch of tiny monitors.
Yeah, the only problem with a lot of Adafruit stuff is they've really standardized on, like, Raspberry Pi stuff. So, like, they want a certain header layout. They definitely want it to be consistent with that.
I think that'd be a good thing.
I'm looking more for a standalone type monitor. It's preferably in a weatherproof case.
Get a monitor, 3D print case.
Did somebody say 3D printer?
That's a pretty good idea.
Seems like every time I come into this mobile room, we get off on the 3D printer tangent. It's awesome.
Oh, we've already been there once since I hopped on here, so.
Excellent.
I'm talking about earlier how I 3D print some of my model trains.
Ah, that's actually pretty groovy. Cool. Speaking of which, I need to fire mine up and do something for a project. I don't know, every time I get to the point of where I'm like, wearable computers would be cool, I just look at my cell phone and I'm like, oh, there it is. It's just it's in my pocket, not on my wrist or, you know, arm or like in front of my face.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. I mean, I'm one who I can't even wear a wristwatch because I'm afraid of breaking it. So I have one of those little clip watches like hikers got, they put on their backpacks. I have one of those attached to my belt.
How do you worry so much about breaking a watch? I've got a cheap Invicta automatic on my wrist right now. I work in a machine shop with several thousand pound parts, and I don't have a single scratch on the thing.
I don't work in a machine shop. I work retail, but I play a little bit rough. I would shoulder check about a stack of banana boxes.
Oh, I'm rough, believe me.
I think I went through, I don't know, at least two watches, wrist watches, where they just, I mean, they were, I've had decent ones, and then I bought a cheap one just because I wanted to have a watch, and it just completely shattered on me and fell into pieces on the floor, so.
Might want to try a G-Shock. They're pretty tough.
I don't know, I definitely look different with a watch attached to my belt, but besides that, I've worn one on my belt since, I don't know, last almost 10 years probably, so it doesn't bother me, and it's they usually last pretty well. I mean, usually it's the clasp, the little strap it's attached to breaks after a while, but other than that, that holds up.
Cool.
I think the question is, do you think you can wear what is essentially a cell phone or a small computer on your wrist while you work at the machine shop?
Could I, or would I be permitted to?
Do you think you can do it without breaking it or harming it in a way where it would make it unusable?
I probably could do it.
I don't know. I just kind of feel like I've got enough things squawking at me telling me I have things to do that a wearable computer would just be more of the same. So I kind of would have avoided it if at all possible. I find myself more and more just turning my phone off and going and hiding in a cave if I can.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Well, one of the things I'd like to do is also have some sort of a near field communications type setup with my keyboard glove, so I can program it to act like various mass transit cards, and I just wave my palm over the gate at a, say, for instance, in the Boston T, and it lets me in.
That would be cool. Are the NFCs like standardized? I mean, is that something you can get access to? We have like zero public transportation here, so I have no idea how that works.
From what I understand, they're all very similar, although the exact the keys and all that will be different from one system to another.
Yeah, and I'm kind of in the whole opposite spectrum of, I would love to have a little bit more flashy lights and things reminding me of things while I'm working. Because really, while I'm working, mentally, I am just really, really bored. I'm pretty much standing in one spot or another, just stacking stuff or pushing things around with no real other communication or things going on. It gets really, really mentally dull.
My job's not much different.
I used to wire houses, and so that was mentally dulling as well. I'm sitting there putting in receptacles over and over and over again.
Now, could you listen to like music or something while you're doing it, though?
Oh, I could. I mean, most of the time I was on my own on the job site, so I could do whatever the hell I wanted to.
See, that's cool, but when you're working on a sales floor in retail, you can't have like a little headphone on. I mean, I'd love to be able to do that, where I can just, you know, have a podcast going in my ear while I just stand there and work and still be able to, you know, converse with the customers, but no one's going to allow that.
Yeah, my line of work, if I don't pay attention for 2 seconds, I'll have a riot on my hands, so I don't have the luxury of listening to anything at work.
Oh, no, 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 no.
Yeah, where I work, we're allowed to have radios, so I went to the thrift store, found a 100-watt amp for $15, hooked it up, and I blast my HPR.
Nice.
Very cool.
You can hear it over probably, a quarter of the shop. I occasionally get complaints, but then I say, what are you complaining about? The content? You need to go tell those guys over in the corner that are listening to loud Howard Stern that they need to turn theirs off first. They generally leave me alone.
For a while there, I listened to, I didn't listen to it, but one of my coworkers was a born and bred Republican, and so that's all I heard all day long was Republican talk radio.
I grew up on Republican talk radio.
I'm sorry.
Eh.
Of course, that being said, I also grew up in a Republican household, so, and this was back when I was in high school, so it was... I didn't object to it at the time.
I listened to a lot of Rush Limbaugh growing up, and whatever. I mean, I was always at least smart enough to take you know, the things that I agree with and take those I don't agree with and just kind of roll with things, you know? You don't, just because you listen to it doesn't mean you have to follow it wholeheartedly.
Yeah, this is true.
I don't know. I feel like anything political, I'm just going to kind of glaze over after a certain amount of time. Maybe it's just me. I went through a phase of my life where I was just like, everything political was interesting, and now I'm just, I don't know, just over it. I can't deal with it anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly where I am now. Go ahead.
I'm just numb because I realize that whatever I do doesn't make a bit of difference.
Hear you there.
See, that's why I've been voting Libertarian for so long. People keep telling me, oh, you're throwing your vote away. Nah, well, maybe one day people will wisen up and go, look, these people are actually getting votes. Maybe we should actually bring them to, I don't know, a debate. And that's until you can have more than just the two parties at a debate on a debate.
Well, the debates are a sham anyway, but I agree. I'm registered Libertarian. Pennsylvania is odd that way in that you can't be put on a ballot unless you get like 1,000 signatures if you're one of the major two parties. If you're a third party, you have to have 20,000 signatures.
Oh, that's not exactly fair.
Pennsylvania, home of corruption.
Well, and it's like, I just remember hearing a bunch of stuff about Larry Lessig when he tried to get in the Democratic presidential debates. There was this loophole where none of the media companies would let you be in the debates unless you had 1% of polling numbers. But all of the polls were run by the media companies, and they wouldn't put him in the polls. So they, like, there was no, he was just standing there like, I'm trying to get in. You guys won't let me in. So it seems like a racket regardless. Doesn't matter what side you're on. It's just sort of whoever wants you to be heard is the one that makes the decision whether you get in or not.
It's like a tautology, you know?
At least your senator's not in the KKK.
So you got that going for you.
And I got a bail going to a hockey game.
I'm not sure being in the KKK is a going for you. I'm not sure how I would classify it, but I wouldn't classify it like that.
I meant the fact that you don't have them in the KKK is one thing you got going for you.
And with that, Happy New Year to Russia, Moscow, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and Muscat.
All right, guys, I got to drop back off in a minute here. Back to work.
Sounds like fun.
Always.
You know, Mumble has this weird thing where if you go to another window or another workspace, it minimizes. But on tiling window managers, that does weird things.
Now, what was the name of the tiling window manager you're using?
Qtile. It's written in Python.
Oh, is that easy to set up?
Well, on Fedora, at least, you just have to do just install it from the package manager. Just do dnf install Qtile.
What about configuring?
Well, I mean, the config file is in Python. If you know Python, then the default config is actually pretty usable, though. So, all right, out of the box, to switch between different workspaces, you use meta ASDF, so like your Windows key, and then A, and then Windows key S, and so on and so forth. It defaults to maximizing everything, but you can configure how it lays out the tiles and all that pretty easily. And I actually have it set up so that I actually can switch between different tile layouts depending on what I'm doing. And each workspace I have has different tile layouts set up. So, for instance, I have a workspace with just Firefox, and that's just maximized. But my terminal workspace, I have it set up so it'll do like an Xmonad type thing where the left-hand side, the left-hand half of the screen is just my one solid terminal, and the right-hand half can be broken up into different applications, and they're tiled horizontally on the right-hand half of the screen.
That's pretty cool. All right, guys, I gotta get going. I'll be able to jump back in here later on.
Have a good day, sir.
You.
I've also got things set up so that, for instance, I have a workspace that's just dedicated to Firefox, like I said, and whenever I first log in, Firefox actually launches on that workspace. I have another workspace for IRC, and what happens is I have a it launches a terminal window, and then which then SSHs into the server that's running my IRC client, and it does all that automatically. You know, it starts up a bunch of odds and ends, like my MPD client starts up, and a lot of automation. So when I first log in, it's ready to go. I don't even have to think about starting anything.
That's pretty cool. I'm just a moron, and I just start the same things every day in the same order, which, you know, is not very Linux-y. I should have, like, at least a script to do that at this point. But I don't know. I just keep on doing the same dumb things.
Yeah, it took me 15 years, I guess, to get to this point. I've also been playing around some with Wayland and Wayland tiling compositors. And unfortunately, however, Wayland is still not quite there to be usable for every day.
Yeah, it would be cool if it was ready to go. I think it's going to be helpful. It's actually, you know, helpful. But I played with it a little bit, and I don't know. There's just so much that X relies on, like so much that it's going to be a while to get it straightened out.
Well, I have found that running Wayland, if I'm just running pure Wayland applications and nothing that requires X Wayland, then my memory footprint is actually somewhat smaller than running X and, you know, the equivalent X applications.
I mean, wasn't that kind of the idea going in, is that we would we would get rid of the behemoth that is X and kind of get something a little more efficient?
Well, yeah, that's one of the ideas. Since I'm into low-powered devices, then that's a definite win. So, which window manager do you use, just out of curiosity?
I'm using GNOME, because that's what I always use. I don't know. It's usually GNOME or Mate, just because it's basically GNOME 2.
Yeah, I used GNOME 2 for probably the first 8 or 9 years of my running Linux. Then I switched to Fluxbox, and then here about a year ago, I switched to Qtile.
Yeah, I keep trying new things. You know, I'll spin something up in the VM and play with it for a little bit. And I keep going back to, you know, this works. I don't need it to do that much. So I do have a love for tiling Windows. That is something that I do appreciate a great deal, but I've not gotten to where I just use that as my desktop.
Well, at this point, my desktop is, it's very early 90s hacker movie-esque, if that makes sense.
It sounds awesome, is what it sounds like.
I have, so I used different terminal emulators for different things. Let me rephrase. I use one terminal emulator, but I use different profiles for different things. So, like, for instance, the profile I have set up for my IRC, the text is green, but my main hacking on things terminal, the text is blue, mostly because that's a little easier on the eyes. I have another profile, terminal profile, set up so that once it hits 9 o'clock at night, it actually turns everything red, and the idea being that red is less likely to keep you awake. Doesn't work very well. I usually stay up till 3 in the morning anyway.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that. Like, I keep reading about it, and I'm like, is that really a thing? Like, is that just something they tell people that is true? I'm not sure. But, yeah, I've heard some people swear by it, and I've heard some people just say, no, it doesn't do anything. It's exactly the same as it was before.
Yeah, I'm starting to think that's really the way it is.
Hang on a couple minutes. I'm going to run over and start up my 3D printer so I can start something. I'll be right back.
All right. Ahoy! Anybody up to anything?
All right, I'm back. Sorry about that.
All right, now it's my turn to be right back.
Roger that.
So what are you printing? What are your thoughts all about Ian Murdoch?
Yeah, what happened? That's... I mean, just kind of watching it go down, I was like, what is happening right now?
It's definitely some suspicious shit.
Yeah, I just don't even know how to, like, parse it. Like, I don't even make it any kind of congruence in my brain. I don't know. It's definitely bizarre.
I mean, I've never quite seen anything quite like it.
It's one of those things that I hope we find out more about it, but at the same time, like, if I was part of the family, I kind of hope that it wouldn't get out if any of that was true or, you know, what happened. I have no idea.
Yeah, things definitely don't quite add up. And the thing is it worries me. You know, that could happen to anybody else.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I don't know. It just seems like if he was in that bad of a place, I don't know. You figure, like, there would have been talk about it, especially as kind of foundational as he was in the community. And being part of Docker is no... Like, Docker is the new hotness. So you figured if there was something going on that... it would have probably made the news before things got out of hand. I don't know. It's very, the Twitter posts are the most erratic and crazy stuff I've seen. So I don't know if he just kind of lost it and that was what that was, or if somebody got a hold of it and knew something was going on, or it just seems weird and bizarre.
I mean, if it was a case of he just lost it, I mean, the tweets would sort of follow that pattern, you know.
It seems like even the most rational of the tweets is irrational. So, I mean, I hope that what he's accusing of have happened didn't happen. It might not surprise me if it did, but I don't know. That's kind of, that's a big leap to take over something like that. I don't know.
I mean, there's been plenty of evidence of similar things happening here in the last couple of years.
Oh, yeah. That's why I wouldn't be surprised if like, that came out to be true. I just think his reaction to it was probably the most troubling. You know, just sort of, it started off like he was like, yeah, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to fight this and stuff. I kind of like, I feel like most people in that situation, especially somebody with as much of a outreach as he had, you know, he could actually make life difficult for some people if that's what actually happened. But it seemed to just go off the rails really fast, like ridiculously fast.
I mean, especially around the time he says that they followed him home, makes you wonder if they saw the first round and was like, yeah, we got to do something about this now. And that's what went down.
Yeah, or they figured out, oh, this is who we have, and we better make sure that everything goes okay from here on out, and it didn't. So, yeah.
But I know one outcome is that no police officers will be fired over this or have their careers, you know, have anything happen to their careers at all. The police will get off scot-free as they usually do.
As much as I wish that if it is something that is wrongdoing, I hope that's not true, but I don't have much faith that it will not be not true, if that makes any sense.
Indeed. I mean, if a cop can get off scot-free for running over the vice president of some company while he was riding his bike, just because the cop was looking at his computer and checking his email while driving, and can get off scot-free, you know.
I found my next defense when I run over somebody, although I don't think it's going to go over as well.
Yeah, you're not a cop, so.
I was just checking my email. I mean, come on.
One of my favorites is in Jacksonville, North Carolina, an Onslow County sheriff. I mean, there wasn't any death, so that's kind of why this is my favorite. But Onslow County sheriff had a bit of road rage and deliberately hit another car, and he got off scot-free. Basically had a week of paid vacation.
Wow, that's kind of terrible. Like, they proved he intentionally hit the person and still got off? That's crazy.
Yeah, they put him on paid administrative leave, which is for a week, which is basically you get paid a paycheck, but you don't have to show up at work. You're on vacation for a week.
Man, that's rough. That's significantly rough, actually. I'm glad nobody got hurt. I mean, or nobody died, at least. I mean, somebody might have got hurt, but that at least makes it comical.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's no one, as far as I know, no one got hurt, but it's still, it's not cool. And it's time to say Happy New Year's to Iran, Tehran, Esfahan, and Bandar Abbas.
Brother, I'm glad you took that one, because I would have murdered those words.
Yeah, my pronunciation of some languages is not so good. I definitely grew up in the South.
My pronunciation of all languages, including English, is suspect at best.
Oh. You should hear me when I'm drunk.
So you were saying earlier you do arm development for Fedora?
Admittedly, not so much now, but I used to be heavily involved with the ARM team, for sure. I helped with porting Fedora to 64-bit ARM, for instance, and this was probably, what, I guess 3 years ago now, 4 years ago. And that was a rather involved project. It took a week, just about, to do a build of GCC, because we weren't doing it on actual hardware. Actual hardware didn't exist yet. It was done entirely within an emulated environment. And so imagine basically building GCC on an Arduino.
Yikes. Yeah. Surprisingly, it took a week.
Yeah, it was definitely involved.
That's cool, though. I mean, it's especially like, I kind of feel like ARM is the next big thing, so that work will definitely pay off in the long run.
Well, if you think about it, in general, RISC gets you better performance than, you know, non-RISC architectures. And that's why Spark and Power give you better performance than Intel, because they're both RISC architectures, and ARM is also RISC. The thing is, ARM has focused on low power consumption, which is kind of counter to high performance, But now that they're starting to go after the higher performance, they're definitely going to catch up with Intel pretty quickly. And in fact, 64-bit ARM has caught up with Intel pretty quickly. I can do a kernel build on 64-bit ARM in about the same time as I can do a kernel build on similarly stacked Xeon hardware.
Well, I know just the difference of just on Chromebooks, being able to run any sort of Linux on ARM. 5 years ago would have been, well, a joke. And now it's, like, respectable, other than, you know, some packages you may have to recompile because they're not built for ARM. But really, I mean, most of the stuff that I want when I do that is out there. So, I mean, that's enough for me most of the time. It's not like I'm planning on doing anything too strenuous, but just the power savings alone, it, to me, would be worth it to try to push towards ARM.
Well, one of the cool things about Fedora is ARM is now a primary architecture. So that means that every package, unless it's something weird, pretty much every package gets built for ARM if you're running Fedora.
That's pretty cool. I never tried to run Fedora in ARM. To be completely honest, I've only run Fedora a couple times on anything, so might be a reason to check it out.
Well, what Chromebook have you got?
I've gone through our district. We're testing a bunch of them now. So I've got, I had the Samsung generation, the first generation Samsung Chromebooks that they brought out, which were terrible. And then I've had the Acer C720, and now we've got the Dell 13 inches. I haven't had a chance to hack around on that one. And I think we've got a Lenovo one that is 11 inches. I'm not sure which exactly that is. I haven't got to hack around on that one either.
Well, that first generation Samsung one was the one I used forever, and it actually would run a virtual machine with full hardware acceleration.
So you ran a virtual machine on the Chromebook?
Indeed. I actually demonstrated that at OLF a couple years ago.
See, now you're making me rethink trying Fedora on that, because that's what I'm a teacher, so my school district, we do one-to-one with Chromebooks, and we're getting ready to pull all those back in, because we're going to hand them a new one next year. And so they're going to turn around and sell them for like $20. So I'm thinking, you know, if I can get that kind of performance out of it, I might just take one home myself and have a, you know, just a little beater Chromebook rig to take around when I don't need something too heavy. Although, if it'll run a VM, that's pretty much about as hardcore as I need to be.
I mean, we're not talking about, you know, don't expect to be playing any hardcore games in said VM, but, you know, but yeah, it'll run a VM as long as it's an ARM VM. You can't run an Intel image on the ARM Chromebook and expect high performance. It has to be native architecture to get KVM.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the heaviest gaming that I plan on doing on anything is probably going to be like NetHack, so I think we're okay. I can pretty much play that on, you know, a couple of sticks that I rubbed together. So,
just fair warning, if you want to do Vert on the Chromebook, you'll need to run a custom kernel and you'll need to replace the U-boot. The stock kernel and the stock U-boot don't have Vert support.
To be honest, I don't think I would need it, but it's impressive that it can do it. Like, it kind of changes my... Because I ran, I think, Ubuntu on it, and I ran Arch on it. Ubuntu ran okay. Arch was a dog on it, and I don't know why. I kept trying to figure it out, and I was like, nah, never mind. It wasn't a rig that I was, you know, it was just kind of goofing around, and I ran out of time, and I gave it back, and so I never played with another one again, so... I might grab one next week when we go back and just put Fedora on it and see what it feels like, and possibly walk off with one when we turn around and sell them. That would be kind of cool to have another just, you know, simple rig to leave around places.
Let me know when you sell them, because I'd like to get a couple of them again just to set up. I actually want to set up a Vert cluster with them. Basically set them up and integrate them into an OpenStack cluster so I can spin up VMs on them at will.
Yeah, as soon as we start selling them, I will definitely hit you up. And then, you know, since I'm going to be the person in charge of that in my building, you would definitely be at the front of the line.
I'd say two or three would be cool. Like I said, they'd basically would sit there in the corner of the room, just plugged in, the lids closed, and doing their thing.
Well, I know my building is going to intake about 500 of them. So now, after the kids are done with them, there's probably only going to be like 100 of them that are actually usable after I part out the pieces that they've broken off of each one to make usable units. But they're not very sturdy machines. The kids trash them quite often.
Well, usable to me means the USB 2 port works, the SD card port works, and the screen works. As long as those three are, you know, well, of course, the power supply. I don't even care about the keyboard. I plug an external keyboard up to it.
Our biggest problems have been with them. They'll break the screen or something that's like super easy to fix, and we'll send it off, and it'll come back from repair, and it'll just have all kinds of problems with it. Like the Wi-Fi doesn't work. So like somewhere along the line, when they were putting the screen in, they yanked out the Wi-Fi cable, and you know, if we open it up, then we can't claim it on insurance anymore. So we can't, like, it's something I could fix in 2 seconds, but we can't do that because it would be a problem. Or the batteries, the charge controller for the batteries goes dead on them constantly. That's been a huge problem too.
Now, like I said, they'd be sitting there plugged in all the time. So, I mean, the battery would pretty much at that point be serving us as kind of a backup.
Let me look around and see what I got. And I might actually have something that fits your needs before that. That's just laying around that we're parting out. That I've got everything off of it that I need that, you know, can do whatever with.
That would be cool. Actually, as it happens, I'm sitting in a hardware shortage at the moment because I've killed most of my hardware in various ways, or I used to have some servers, but I sold them, and now I'm sitting here and I want to do a bunch of stuff, and I don't have enough compute.
I has not enough computes. Must has more.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've toyed around with the idea of just a Chromebook is a new laptop, because it's like, it's other than like ThinkPads, it's one of the few things that's just like guaranteed to work most of the time. You just put Linux on, it'll work.
Well, that Samsung Chromebook I had, I went 6 months. That was my only laptop. And I was running Fedora on it. This was back when I was still using Fluxbox, and Fluxbox is low enough resources that it did everything I wanted to do flawlessly. The only thing I didn't like about it was the internal storage was tiny.
See, that's why I had that the Acer C720 or something. The SSD on it was so easy to rip off and put a new one in. Like, they even had a hatch for it. So it was like, if you wanted to, that was the one of all of them that I've played with. If I was going to buy one, that would be the one I bought. Because it was Intel too. So you didn't even have to worry about the ARM thing. It was, it just ran, but battery life sucked. So I'm thinking if you could get something that ran ARM, you might be able to get at least better battery life, probably nothing comparable to actual Chrome OS because it's optimized for that, but at least a little better. That the Intel would, I mean, you're talking, it was rough. It was like 45 minutes to an hour, and it was about done.
Well, when I was running Fedora on my Chromebook, my average battery life was about 8 hours or so, and that was doing things like listening to, I didn't listen to music because the kernel I was running didn't have audio support. That didn't exist yet. But otherwise, you know, doing normal everyday stuff, doing the internet, building packages, just compiling all kinds of stuff. Just everything I do on a normal laptop, I do on that thing, and the battery would last 8 hours.
Yeah, see, that's what I would want. Because a laptop, I mean, my laptop that I'm on right now, you know, it's my main computer, it's what I use most of the time, but it's plugged into a wall most of the time. it's a laptop only in name. It's not really portable. Having something that has that kind of battery life would be much preferable.
Yeah, now I'm on it's an AMD based laptop, but you know, it's still Intel architecture, and it's getting old. It's hit the 4 year mark, and the battery in it is starting to get dodgy. I get about 30 minutes battery life out of it.
That's not a bad run for a laptop battery, to be completely honest. four years is long compared to what most of mine have always been.
I guess I've been kind of on the careful side with it.
I'm not. I just leave it plugged in all the time, and basically everything you're not supposed to do, I do. So I'm sure all the battery problems I've ever had are self-caused.
Actually, one of the cool things about this Samsung Chromebook is it's actually possible to replace the system firmware, so you can actually get it to be FSF-free if you so desire.
Really? Is it, I guess, use core boot, or how does that work?
You can actually put your own custom U-boot on it, and now, mind you, this requires hooking up all kinds of stuff to the motherboard and doing some tinkering, and you have a high probability of breaking it, but it's doable.
Sounds like fun.
That's one of the cool things about ARM is most of your ARM boards, actually, the bootloader is the firmware. So if you replace the bootloader with, you know, a non-binary, then you've got an FSF-free device. Now, and like I said, in most cases, there are instances where you can't quite do that because in order to get the thing to boot, you have to use their proprietary binary blob. But if you didn't need that, then you could replace the bootloader and go fully free.
Wow. Yeah. That's super cool, man. now I want one again. Because I just every time we get one, like, it's kind of a well-known thing that they have everybody test it like the way a normal person will use it, and then they hand it to me, and I, you know, try to break it. And I've got to play with a lot of devices that way.
Nice.
Yeah, it's worked out well for me. But I've still not found anything that I was 100% happy with, but I have not played. To be fair, I've never played with Fedora on one, and it sounds as though, like, you guys did a lot of work to get that going. So definitely something I'm going to give a shot to.
Yeah, if you're interested, I once did a blog post about it, running Fedora on it. This is, admittedly, I'm not quite sure what the current situation is, mostly because, like I said, I broke mine, and so I haven't kept up with it since then. But if you want to run an older Fedora image on it, I've got one available for download. I can put in the show notes right quick. You just extract the tarball, DD it to an SD card, and boot off the SD card.
Sweet. Yeah, I would definitely at least put it in the show notes, because that's a good reference point, regardless. Kevin, I think that's the unit we're talking about. I could be wrong, but that looks exactly like the one we're talking about, at the very least. I don't know if internally it's the same. It says it's got the Exynos 5, which is the same exact thing. So I can't imagine why it wouldn't work the same. If it's not the same thing, then it wouldn't work the same way.
Yeah, okay. They've actually added a model number to it that didn't seem to exist before. When I got mine, it was just the Samsung Chromebook. It didn't have a model number, but yeah, this looks like it.
I don't know about internally, but I know they quit making this model to buy, so our schools had to replace them with the next generation, the Samsung Chromebook 2s. And wow, those were built way better than that first generation.
Yep, that's the one. So yeah, I went and added a link to the file system image you need to run Fedora on it. Now, like I said, it's pretty old at this point. And what was it? The kernel I have there is actually also missing a feature needed to run something. I forget what it was. I think it was actually the wireless. So yeah, it's the internal wireless doesn't work with that kernel, mostly because it hadn't been upstreamed yet. But if you use a newer kernel, you should be able to get it to work. I've played around with building a newer kernel, but I haven't been able to test it since I haven't had a Chromebook to test it on. If I get my hands on another one, I'll do a new kernel build with probably a 4.4 kernel and give that a shot. Now, what I would like to do is play with one of the newer, I think there's a 64-bit Chromebook, ARM Chromebook out now. I'd like to play with one of them as well. That would probably be a pretty decent machine for running everyday Linux on. Just bear in mind that all the work on 64-bit ARM, well, most of the work for 64-bit ARM, as far as everyday Linux is concerned, has been targeting the server realm. So I'm not entirely sure how well the graphics stack would work. Speaking of Samsung, I learned the other day that Samsung single-handedly accounts for 17% of South Korea's GDP.
I don't find that surprising at all. Samsung is everywhere in South Korea, man. And they do everything, like heavy loaders, Samsung on the side of a refrigerator, Samsung. It's just like, surprised they don't sell cars yet.
Actually, apparently they do make cars, and they also make tanks.
Wow. Then I want a Samsung tank. That's if it exists, I have to have one now.
I guess it'd be about in the same realm as buying a new tank. Well, buying an Abrams. I mean, I guess
you have enough cash, you could theoretically do it.
You think my Prime shipping would count if I get it on Amazon? You think they'd ship it over here for free?
I rather doubt that. I don't think they're listed on Amazon. eBay, however.
I have a sneaking suspicion somebody would put some pressure on PayPal to make that not happen.
Yeah, I think the feds might take offense to importing tanks. Now, if you could get them imported without the guns, you know, just call it an all-terrain off-road vehicle.
To be honest, I'm not even really... The guns aren't even the selling point. It's just an effing tank. I mean, just to be able to mob around town in a tank. I mean, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, that would be pretty cool. Right up until you tore up all the streets and, you know, from the treads and have to pay the town to replace them all.
If I've got enough money to buy a tank, I'm probably set. I'm probably okay with that.
You have a point there. You have a point. Just get a piece of 5-inch steel pipe and weld it to the front of it.
Only if when I press the button, it like shoots out a little flag that says bang. That would be the best.
That would be pretty hilarious. You could go skeet shooting with it. And Happy New Year to Iraq, Baghdad, Khartoum, Nairobi, and Addis Ababa.
I think if I'm shooting skeet with a tank, somebody's going to have to fling like Volkswagens in the air for me to take out. It's going to have to be something substantial.
There is a YouTube video of someone shooting skeet with a Sherman tank, and the skeet are quite large.
I can imagine. When the shells are like 6 times bigger than the actual things you're trying to shoot, that seems counterproductive.
They're a good couple of feet in diameter, for sure. Now, mind, with a Sherman, you know, I think you're talking about, well, right, they had a range of guns, but 75 millimeter would be my guess, was probably what this particular one had. So, large-ish, yes. A little bigger than your standard hunting rifle, but not huge.
They're not lobbing mortars in the sky and stuff like that.
Now, the main gun on a modern main battle tank is going to be quite large in comparison. So yeah, if you get one of the Samsung tanks, just out of curiosity, do you know anything about naval gunnery?
No, I do not, actually.
So, one of my hobbies is World War I naval technology and naval history.
Sounds groovy.
So, did you know that your average World War I battleship had just as much networking going on as a modern office?
Really?
The networks were all analog. There wasn't any digital, but yes, they existed.
That's pretty cool, actually. Like, it's not what you would think at that time would be going on, but that is cool.
Yeah, it was a lot of data transmission, but most of it was voice transmission, obviously. So, phone systems, that sort of thing. But there was also a fairly substantial amount of data transmission.
Now, is that internal to the ship or, like, ship to ship?
Internal to the ship.
That's cool. They had their own communication network on board. That's just thinking about that period in time. It's just weird to think about. Yeah, they did have that stuff. Like, it's not as fancy as we think it is.
Well, like I said, it was all analog. So, but you know, it's not. It wasn't. You know, for instance, it wasn't. How should I put this? It wasn't radio based analog. So it wasn't like, say, a TV signal that you could really easily jam. It was. Applying various, it was amplitude modulation on a standard AC circuit. So not really something that a lot of interference would really hurt, depending on which way you set it up. Now, there was also direct current data transmission, depending on which system you're talking about. But it was definitely a mix.
See, now that kind of thing is very interesting. Like, you're talking about this, and I'm like, really? Now I need to, like, do some research on this, because that sounds really cool.
Dreadnoughtproject.org. I'll go ahead and drop a link into the show notes. So, shameless plug, I'm one of the editors for the site. I focus on the Austro-Hungarian Navy. But depending on which nationality you were talking about, somewhat different methods of gunnery fire control. For instance, the British are probably the best studied, mostly because they had what is arguably one of the more successful systems, and their system, their documentation survived. The Germans lost a lot of documents during World War II because
Well, Berlin kind of burned.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can't imagine how that happened.
The Russians actually also carted off a bunch of surviving documents. And so researching the Germans and the Austrians is difficult. As far as the French, as far as I know, no one's really looked into them too deeply. The Turks generally bought their ships from other countries, so whichever country built the ship in question is the system that that ship would have.
Wow, there's a lot of information on this site, man. This is crazy.
We've been working on it for several years now. But, like I said, my focus has been on the Austrians. And the Austrians use a lot of German technology, but they also, their methodology was homegrown. So, like, they use a lot of Siemens gear for data transmission, and Siemens relied on AC synchros. And I've actually gone and Siemens was kind enough to go and patent all this stuff back in the early 1900s. So you can actually go and look at the U.S. patents for it and see how it worked.
Wow, one time the patent system didn't suck.
It's probably the best use for it is actually doing historical research. So, because you have to, the standards for documentation are extremely high, high enough that you can reproduce whatever it is that's being patented. So one of my current projects and interest is actually taking the database for this wiki and actually running it through Elasticsearch and seeing how I can apply, you know, modern computer science to historical research. And I'm going to probably write up a few blog posts about that here in the next couple of months.
That's pretty cool. I'm just sitting here looking at, like, I just went to fire control just to see, like, what was there. There's, like, probably 150, 200 links off of that page. Like, there's a lot to learn.
Oh, yes, it's definitely an involved topic, and I've actually submitted a talk on it for LibrePlanet in Boston here in March, so if I get selected, I'll be giving a talk on it.
When in March is that?
I believe the weekend of the 19th and 20th. Let me check.
I try to go to that. Felt kind of, I don't know, feel that empty void where NELF used to be. Feel bad I didn't go to it last year because I want to say Ken Stark was there. That was his last talking appearance, I believe.
At March 19th and 20th.
Did he ever get something sorted out for his voice synthesis stuff? I know he was kind of struggling with it for a while. Has anybody heard from him?
I don't know. I don't think he has. At least nothing open source. He might have gone the proprietary route just because.
Well, to be completely honest, working in that sort of world, there's nothing in open source that can hold a candle to the proprietary stuff that's out there right now. So I don't actually blame him for doing so. I would stick with eSpeak. I would make everybody listen to me talk through eSpeak because I can't because I'm a baller. You know, I can understand that if you were somebody who had to talk to a lot of people and didn't want to sound that way, that you would have to go proprietary.
I actually don't mind eSpeak at all. I mean, I used to listen to audiobooks. There was one of the audiobook programs for Android that basically just kind of converted everything to eSpeak, and I used to listen to books that way, and it was, I had no problem with it. And I set up a little thing myself where I converted EPUB books into text files, and then used eSpeak on the text file to create an audio file, and I had no problem listening to books that way. It doesn't bother me, but I can understand when you're working with children, you don't want to frighten the children. You don't want to be the creepy robot guy trying to teach you about computers.
I don't know about anybody else, but that's exactly who I want to teach me about computers. Somebody with a creepy robot voice and an eye patch. That sounds awesome.
Have a Cylon teaching me about computers.
Exactly. That I'm down for. But, yeah, I mean, it's just, until you, like, eSpeak works for me, too, but it's not my main mode of communication. Like, there is, in speech synthesis, there's a lot that are out there. Like, it's crazy how good some of it is. And there's just not enough, I don't know, not enough need or not enough interest in doing an open source version that is that robust, I think. I think MaryTTS kind of it goes that way. There's a lot of work on it, but it's so kind of cumbersome and it doesn't really interface with anything. So it makes it kind of hard to use, I think.
It's got to be one of those things that people try to get to work with things, and then the second they start to fail, they either, oh, well, this doesn't work, and then, you know, move on to something else, and then either move on to just eSpeak or move on to something, you know, proprietary. But there's got to, from everything I've heard about Mary TTS, it seems to be a very a system. Because I remember about two New Year's Eve spec where we're talking to Jonathan Nato about working with I forget the program to talk to you, have the computer talk to you. That's, either way, have that work with work with Mary TTS, and it seems like if the people have the time and effort, then it should be able to get it to work. And it seemed very robust, and it seemed like, I mean, it's based on the idea of what you can read. If you read into it or whatever, you can actually use a person's voice as something, and that sounds like a good base for something incredible. I mean, I guess it's just going to take time and actual dedication to get something like that working.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a lot of things going for it. I will give it that. But every time that I've played with it, and granted, that's not a whole lot, and so I'm sure people have looked at it more in depth than I have. It's just the fact that it is its own, and this is my Unix brain. I can't pipe Mary TTS to something. Like, I can't write a script to where I can, you know, type things in and then it spits out, you know, audio like I can with Festival. Festival's awesome. You know, I can do that all day long. I can take a laptop and set up a kid who, you know, has done nothing with computers, and I can literally write a script in 5 minutes, and that kid can type in stuff and the computer will speak it. Now, it will sound pretty terrible because it's, you know, only the engines that are working with it. But as far as I know, there's no way to take a Mary TTS voice system, like, I don't even know what they would call it, how they would, like, a package of a certain voice and pipe it through something else. I'm sure that's something that is going to happen, but I think they're just sort of starting down this path. And so the more traction it gets, the better it will be. The fact that it's open source makes me a little happy because it means people can take what they're doing and move on and do it and stuff. I think one of the big problems that a lot of people kind of are not using it is it's in Java. And I think Java is just kind of something people don't want to deal with.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Java myself. The thing I'm interested in is kind of the opposite, speech to text. That's an area that is pretty much utterly lacking in free software.
Now, I heard, I forget where it was, I think it was one of the Jupiter Broadcasting shows, somebody brought up that the Mycroft guys that are doing that have gotten so much backlash from sort of the open source community that part of their project is now going to be trying to develop some kind of speech-to-text engine that is open source that people can self-host because they just don't want it calling out. But, you know, it's all fun and games to talk about it, but it's like when you actually have to get down to the code, that's where it might be a problem. I wish somebody would come up with a great open source engine. That would be amazing. I just don't know what the incentive would be.
Well, supposedly, Sphinx supposedly has had a lot of work done on it, but I mean, I'm a pretty Unix and Linux savvy guy, you know, and I can't get Sphinx to work.
Well, my understanding is to get any kind of speech to text to be functional or at least good is you have to have enough reference material for the program to parse through. And so that's why Google's is so good, is because they spent all those years that everybody was using Google Voice. Every conversation they had was recorded and put through a computer so the computer could learn language and how it worked and be able to recognize it. I just don't think there's enough data out there to do it reliably. I mean, you could throw anything you wanted into it and it would work, I guess. But it's just who's going to do that?
It's kind of like my historical research or documentation in applying computer science to it. You know, the biggest problem I'm running into is a lot of historical documents are not digitized in a way that's computer readable. I mean, at the best, you have scans in a lot of cases, and then you go and try to run OCR on them, and, well, free OCR is not that great. And then when you toss in that it's 100-plus years old, and, well, and even relatively difficult for a human to read, that was that really adds to the complication. So a lot of filling in, a lot of doing this project means going in and manually transcribing historical documents, and then, and that's a lot of work.
Yeah, that's another thing, like, with OCR. Like, Google swears that their OCR is Tesseract. And I'm like, then what special sauce are you using, and why have you not upstreamed it? Because your OCR is way better than Tesseract is. Like, because I've used Tesseract. It's not that good. Like, what are you doing? There's some secret sauce they got going on with it.
Sorry to bring up the conversation, but I got to get going. I just want to take this moment to thank you guys for coming on here. When 50 and I first decided to kind of push this, because originally I thought that this was going to go away this year, that we weren't going to do a New Year's Eve show, but 50 and I kind of pushed for it. And even then, we got it together kind of at the late notice, so we didn't know what to expect for people actually showing up. So I just want to take this moment and thank you guys for showing up and participating in this. I appreciate it a lot, and I mean, this has been, the New Year's Eve show has always been one of my favorite shows to listen to, because it's just general conversation. So thank you all for coming. Thank you, Taj, for your help with the Etherpad. I appreciate it a lot.
Oh, no worries, man. Anytime, you know that.
All right, I got to sign off. Man, go ahead.
I was going to say, I was on last year, and I'm happy to be on this year. So, thank you, sir.
I'm just happy I'm able to do it this year. I'm at home, unlike normal.
Thank you.
Later, Honky.
Actually, I've got to hop off for probably about 20 minutes myself. I'll be back here shortly.
All right, I'll catch you then, man.
And I'm returned. What's up? And so, it's time to say Happy New Year's to Greece, Cairo, Ankara, Athens, and Bucharest.
I'm back!
Oh no.
So has there been any need to add spots to the mumble while I've been gone?
I believe it's mostly been handled.
Okay, I should be around at least until I fall asleep tonight, which may be relatively early.
Apparently, during World War I, the British used Royal Marines to command and operate their turrets on their major warships.
Yeah, I'd heard something like that.
Major Francis Harvey saved HMS Lion from blowing up by ordering the turret be flooded, which killed him, but it saved the ship, and he got the Victoria Cross for that.
Well, that's a very commendable thing to do. Who's been in since I left?
A few people. Yep, OCR sucks.
Sorry I didn't copy that.
I was lamenting that OCR is just pretty bad.
Yeah, I know. They said when we got faster processors, then that would take care of it, and it still hasn't in 20 years.
And the problem is, when it's actually good enough to be human readable, but not quite good enough that you're sure that, you know, numerical figures, for instance, are completely accurate, and then you have to manually check everything.
And by the time you do that, you might as well have typed it in the first place.
Exactly. However, it is interesting reading this stuff. Ships of the 5th Battle Squadron, as this was far superior in gunpowder to the 1st Scouting Group, and the speed of the slowest ships was such as to enable it to keep out of range of superior enemy forces. The operation, however, showed that the ships of the 3rd Squadron of the High Seas Fleet, which was the German fleet, possesses an unexpected turn of speed for at any rate a short period. The Queen Elizabeth class are nominally 20-knot vessels. The official quarterly return of British and foreign war vessels gives the Koenig and Kaiser classes a design speed of 20.5 knots. I have always expected that they might reach 22 knots for a short distance, but the fact that the 5th Battle Squadron was unable to increase its distance from the German ships when steaming at their utmost speed comes as an unpleasant surprise and will give considerable effect on the conduct of future operations. It is quite evident that all German ships possess a speed much in excess of that for which they are nominally designed.
Right. That's why one of the reasons the Bismarck, the next war, was so much a problem, because it was at least as fast as any of the British ships.
Well, this is World War One. I'm reading this. I'm reading from the official British logs.
Well, I mean, what I learn a little bit about naval history, because every time I come across a ship in a book or a movie or a reference someplace, I always look it up on Wikipedia, see what I can find out about it. But one interesting thing is the first British iron battleships. Built about the same time as we had the Maine, they had a huge problem getting breech-loading cannons to operate effectively. They couldn't get them to work right, so they actually had battleships with muzzle-loading cannons. In other words, they'd have to bring the cannons down over the deck and load them by hand with rams and stuff. Fortunately, I think they had that worked out just before World War One, or they would have really been in a serious disadvantage. Same thing with planes. This is where all my time goes. If I come across a plane mentioned in an article or a reference somewhere, then I go look it up on the Wikipedia, and Wikipedia always says, well, you know, this is a variant of this, or this replaced this, or this other plane was replacement for it, and it's just a vicious circle. All of a sudden, I've got, 10 Wikipedia pages open on aircraft. And coming home from town, I encountered one of my pet peeves. I believe I've mentioned this before in a standalone HPR. I had to go. The only thing I needed in town while I was in town was to grab a phone card for for my Walmart phone, Straight Talk, to renew it before tomorrow. And so there I'm walking across into Walmart, and of course you got to walk across traffic, and saw a guy coming, so I stopped to let him cross. And again, this is my pet peeve. I always stop for cars rather than expecting them to stop for me, because, they can cover the distance almost instantaneously, so they don't really bother me walking. But, of course, what always happens, I've got eye contact with the driver. He can see that I'm not going to walk out in front of him. But instead of continuing, the driver stops, waves at me, and I'm waving back at him, so we're both waving at each other, and nobody's going anywhere.
And I just totally sat here talking without push to talk.
Yeah, that happens once in a while. Well, literally happens to the best of us, because that's what Dan Washko does about half the time.
Emacs is trying to analyze all this text I just pasted into it.
Now, I say Jay Rulo sitting down in the lounge. Has he been there a while?
I'm not sure.
He shouldn't have any trouble joining the room if he wants to. Let me drop down there real quick and see if he's having trouble moving into the room. Well, he's muted, so I guess if he'll find a way to let us wave his hand at us and let us know if he needs help with anything.
Indeed.
He's in Hawaii, so he may be just about getting up.
Hanging out on the beach, maybe.
That's where I'd be.
Yeah, I've never been to Hawaii.
Yeah, the travel's a bit of a pinch, plus accommodations once you get there. That's not a cheap destination.
It's about the same cost to fly to Europe, and you can stay in Europe very cheaply.
Yeah, I've gone over that a couple times with the last known God. Well, I guess I saw it someplace. I think some of the northern countries, actually from the East Coast to Norway, is like $90, but last known God says the trouble is everything once you get there is 10 times the price as it is here.
What you do is you fly to somewhere where it's cheap to fly to, and then you take the local transportation to a country that's cheaper to hang out in.
Well, I was about to say the same thing. Take the train wherever. Europe is all connected, except for England, and you can certainly get there. And welcome, Seb. Are you growing more Sebs?
Well, England is connected by train, if you think about it. You've got the tunnel.
Well, yeah. I was thinking of that. So, yeah, I would think train travel in Europe would be relatively cheap.
Testing.
Hey, Seb.
Howdy, howdy.
Can everyone hear me okay? And I'm doing this without a headset, so... Well, I'll see what happens, really.
No, it's not too bad. It doesn't sound like too much like feedback. If two of us keyed at the same time, it might be a problem.
Oh, yeah. But I'll try like this anyway. I'm not 100% sure what my headset is, and I don't really want to be looking for it right now, but I might later.
It does sound like you've got a little bit of a buzz going on, but it's not too terribly bad. We can understand you easily enough.
Yeah, and the listeners will be able to understand you. It's not like you're wrecking the show or anything, so... Yeah, I think you're cool. Handsome Pirate, the other day you were talking about being able to travel and stuff with your new work. So how is that going?
Well, right now I'm actually at my dad's place, you know, doing the holiday thing. I'm not quite traveling yet, but I'm planning on doing it next year for sure. Probably starting around August, because there's a Fedora conference in Vienna I'll be going to.
Oh, sweet.
So, I'm not going with the SEP. It's just to do with the servers and names and stuff. So, different names, really. And I got in here and I was thinking about trains. I don't know. Most Europe is connected by train, and so is the UK by the Channel Tunnel, sure.
Right. We're just saying that we'd found out earlier that... I think it's to Norway or maybe just about all those northern countries up there that the you can actually get a flight, if you book it right, from the U.S. to Europe, to northern Europe, at least for $90. I would say, but I've been told once you get there, it's very expensive. So, first thing I would do is jump myself on a train and go someplace where it wasn't.
Although the trains are... they're not cheap in the UK. It really isn't. And apparently they're going up in price as well. And the service, it seems a luxury, but really it's not a luxury at all. You're probably not really in first class either. And I've read that they're going to go up again. So you spend like, just to go 2 hours, you basically spend £80, which is not that cheap on the train, really.
Yeah, that doesn't sound very good. Maybe revise my plan to buy an old beater car or something, drive across Europe. They let you do that?
But I think in our mainland of Europe, on the other hand, I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I think the train services are generally better as well and cheaper.
I've seen mentioned that taking a train from Vienna to, say, Prague, for instance, was like $8 US.
Yeah, possibly. So when's this going to get released? Because I think I've heard that, well, in the archive that it's going to come out like a normal show, is that right?
Yeah, we couldn't promise anybody at all was going to show up, so the way we worked it out with Ken is just say, hey, we'll just edit it, you know, we're going to try to do it in a timely manner, but, you know, we'll get the show edited and released and just... Honky and I will release it in the normal schedule, instead of reserving slots for it. Actually, you know, we haven't broke the server or anything yet today, but so far there's been enough to keep the show going for the most part.
Well, yeah, it's been done the other years, but it hasn't been advertised as much this year, but that's okay, I guess. Although it would be possibly a bit more busy if it had been, but by at this time as well, but so be it then.
Yeah, I kind of dropped the ball on getting a promo out this weekend. See, everything's kind of been up in the air, so it's, you know, unlike previous years, we couldn't go and... make a promo and make announcements 2 weeks ahead of schedule and know exactly what was going on. So we really didn't know exactly what we were going to do until this last weekend. And even then there were some changes that wouldn't have, if I'd gotten the promo out, there were some changes that wouldn't have been reflected in it because they were made later. So, like I said, we're just recording this and, at the end of it, I mean, definitely we're going to have some content, so we'll see how much it is and break it up into 3 or 4 or 5 shows and just record it in the normal, you know, in the normal stream because, well, for one thing, I think most of the people who are interested are probably going to be on the show sometime during the day. And, you know, people, and there's probably not going to be a lot of people who are just missed the show and are just sitting there with bated breath waiting for it to be released.
Oh, yeah, that's true. People will probably actually come on who are interested enough. And I don't know if anyone's actually listening to this right now as we say all this, but if you are, come on, get this out to some more people, it'll be a bit better.
Yeah, if you're listening to this, I'm sure you know the details, but everything you need to know to get on is on the website hackerpublicradio.org. At least on the East Coast, you ought to be done with the workday there, and Central, it's, you know, it's late enough you can shag off the rest of the workday. Your boss has probably already left.
Yeah, no, here it actually is nearly New Year saying that. Nearly.
I've been using a.
We heard I've been using.
Yeah, not quite sure where I was going with that.
An Ubuntu phone, a Yola phone, some sort of crowd-funded tech device. I bought something interesting this year like that. Some sort of Linux-based something or the other.
Well, I've definitely been using Linux-based devices. I've actually been playing with FreeBSD here lately, but I'm not going to give up my Fedora.
Why is that? No, go ahead, Handsome Pirate.
That was Seb.
I said, why is that? Why wouldn't you give up Fedora for FreeBSD?
I just like the tool flow and the way it works better.
Well, I think the BSD is some kind of Linux compatibility layer for Flash, which is luckily being replaced by, well, nearly, by open formats and stuff instead. HTML5 and that.
I'm not even referring to them. The underlying toolchain, you know, at the command line, I just prefer, you know, Fedora's better than FreeBSD's. I've tried a few other BSDs as well. FreeBSD would be great for a storage server, but running it on a laptop,
I suppose. I haven't really used it, I think I installed it on a virtual machine or something, and then there was some issue or something, but quite a while ago. But most people just think Linux, and then BSD is there as well, but not many people actually bother with BSD and think about Linux in reality. It's probably true, pretty much.
I probably heard about BSD about the same time I first learned about Linux, because, I mean, actually I know I would have, but it was easier to find stuff about Linux even back then.
I was meaning to buy a free BSD logo t-shirt at Fosdem, but they hadn't. I mean, I've got the event bag, sure, but I can get a t-shirt. I've got another one for another BSD. But then I don't have a stand there now. But yeah, there's Fosdem coming up saying that next year at the end of January. And also, there's also Scale of South Carolina, whatever it's called. And I want to mention that one personally because. There's actually going to be a Magia stand at that event, the American event, in a few weeks, and it's never had a stand in America at any event, so if anyone here is going to that, which is probably a lot of the listeners to this actually, that's something you might be interested in. One of our guys is going to be running a stand there. What's it called? South California Linux Annual Expo, isn't it? Scale. Doesn't be silly.
Yeah, I stepped away to get some soda. It's weird. I could have sworn, you know, just as I was pouring soda out, I heard somebody knock on the door. Maybe it's the ice machine making noise or something. So I go open the door, and there's nobody there, and I walk around the garage, nobody there either. So my imagination, I guess. However, put me just in the right position to look up as the bald eagle I've been seeing around the house flew straight overhead. So that was cool.
Yeah, did anyone actually hear my little advert just now? There's only two of you, but did anyone actually hear it just now?
Yeah, did you say you were going to Scale or just letting everybody know about it?
No, there's one of our, I met him actually at FOSDEM 2014. We've got an American contributor who's done a lot of events as well, so he's decided he's running a stand there. So, and it's never actually had a stand outside, as far as I know, anywhere. Well, no, it hasn't really, anywhere outside France or Belgium or Germany. There's never been a Magia stand, so anywhere else, so this will be the first time as well. And it's in America. I'm supposed to be a lot bigger than FOSDEM, apparently. So I'm just sort of saying, if anybody is going to that who's listening to this, that there will be a stand for that project there as well this time.
That's kind of cool.
Say that again?
I said that's kind of cool.
But I would have thought there'd be quite a few people who actually listen to this who would go to that event, because it's always mainly Americans and stuff on HBR.
Well, you know, Adam Williamson used to be involved with Mandriva.
Yeah, I know that.
He's in Vancouver, Canada.
Yeah, he used to be involved with Mandriva. I knew that.
Now I know him because he's basically the Fedora QA lead, and so I guess you can say he's my boss within the Fedora project, as much as I have a boss.
Oh, you're Fedora ambassador, are you?
Amongst other things.
Right, yeah, okay. So I'm not going to get to BSC then, going back to earlier, that explains that even more.
Hey, 50, I'm not finding these cheap flights you mentioned.
Well, I know they came up here a while back. I can't remember who referenced them to me, but somebody had found them. Yeah, and also at scale, Lord D, Matt Williams, he'll be there. And from several podcasts that people like Tilts and that folks will listen to, and HPR, and also Ryan Sipes, who is the chief technical officer for Mycroft, and we were talking about crowdfunding a few minutes ago. Mycroft AI is the home automation and AI system that's based on the Raspberry Pi. He'll be there, and I'm certain Mycroft will have a booth. So anybody going to scale, look up Ryan and Matt and say hello for us.
Yeah, that sounds a list. Again, obviously at full time as well, there'll be certain known people here and there as well. Some of them pretty much come every year. But that's the good thing about these events, actually, as well, is you get to meet, sometimes you get to meet some pretty interesting people who you might have only really heard of from the online world, but then you get to meet them in person.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of people I've been wanting to meet for a long time that I met at OLF this year, and met other people at PenguinCon, which is up there close to Detroit. Met the cast from Sunday Morning Linux Review. And so, now that I have the opportunity to go, I'm going to try to make it to at least a couple cons a year.
It was interesting. A lot of the Oddcast Planet folks meet up at OLF every year. And every time I've gone, it's always been interesting hanging out with them.
Yeah, I think it's getting where more people go to Self, I think, which is right in the middle of Weed Harvest. There's no way I'm ever getting to Self. But, you know, OLF used to be the big one, used to be where all the Tilts guys would meet up every year, and the only one there this year, well, I won't say, there was Joel and, I'm embarrassing myself by forgetting who I'm talking about. Just a minute.
What's Self? It sounds, obviously, it's an American event, I guess, Linux Fest. Where was it?
Southeast Linux Fest.
Say that again?
Southeast Linux Fest.
I think I heard it. Yeah, I heard about it in an article or something, so I kind of knew.
Actually, it was my first Linux Fest, back when it was still down in South Carolina.
Mine was actually FOSDEM, so that was good. And then I've gone to a UK one as well, and I've been doing events the last few years.
Well, if you can, come August, if you can make it to Vienna, come to Flock, which is the Fedora Developers Conference, and come hang out.
Nah, I probably can't really do that one. It will because of, you know, money for travel and so on. Otherwise, I would do it, possibly, maybe.
Yeah, as Alan Metzler's the other person from Tilts that I met. And, of course, Door-to-Door Geek and a bunch of his crowd. So I've reviewed that before, but on different shows. But it was good to meet those meet that bunch of people. And what I may do is take in different conferences, you know, every year, and eventually get to meet everybody, I hope.
Well, that's interesting. Microsoft is a gold sponsor at Scale.
That I've seen them sponsor. Yeah, I've seen that they've sponsored certain events before for Linux. Maybe even FOSDEM or something like that. But yeah, so it doesn't surprise me too much. But although the new Microsoft is apparently more friendly with all this anyway.
And yeah. While I'm mentioning it, I want to invite everyone who's listening to the show to come to Kansas Linux Fest. This will be our second year. Looks like I think it's going to be in early May this year. So when it gets closer, I'll keep everybody up to date. We had a very successful first year. It's kind of going to be under different management this year. A couple of the Wichita, well, it's essentially the
I wouldn't really want to go to an American event, so something like Libra Planet, even. But thing is, of course, that's quite far from the UK, and planes are not cheap and all that, so it doesn't really happen.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Claude 2 went to Libra Planet this year.
He went to the one in Raleigh. All Things Open.
Oh, okay, you're right.
I've actually submitted a talk to Libra Planet, although I don't know if it's been accepted yet or not.
A talk about what?
Naval gunnery fire control in World War I and the data networks involved.
Oh, right, okay.
Now, did they have fire directors that early?
They did, actually, and quite an impressive data network in each ship, you know, transmitting. It was all analog, it wasn't digital, but they had as much in the way of, you know, big bundles of network cable, if you will, as any modern business would.
And you obviously know more about this than I do. I saw a documentary on the Hood versus the Bismarck the other day, and if you notice naval vessels on the sides of the bridge, you usually have these walkways that extend in the open air out, you know, at least to the edge of the ship, if not a little beyond. And what that's for is you've got a guy out there with a dial, essentially. In other words, if you want to know your distance from another ship and its speed and its course, so you don't run into it, you know, you've got this dial thing that, you know, the guy on the port side of the ship points his dial at the ship that you're interested in, and the guy on the starboard side points his at it, and between those two figures, either mechanically or by, you know, doing the trigonometry, they can figure out, you know, where that ship is exactly in respect to your own ship, and, you know, the distance and the exact direction. And then, of course, by taking multiple readings, you get the heading and the speed of the ship. And I think maybe some of the earlier fire control relied on that, but you know, essentially the modern fire control, you've got a deal sort of like that, but it's a turret, so they can turn the thing all the way around to face the ship that you're trying to shoot at, and it's far more sophisticated.
Well, your optical rangefinders were, think about basically a giant pair of binoculars. And by adjusting them so that you make your two images become one image, you then get basically you set the focus. And when you know that when you're focused at a certain distance, then that's how far away, you know, whatever you're looking at is. And so that's how they did rangefinders.
Yeah, if you watch like the old war movies, they'll have a guy looks like he's looking into this funky pair of binoculars because the tubes go, you know, the lenses are way up above his head and way further apart than your eyes would be. So yeah, they knew how to line that up on the target, and then they would twist a knob until, like you said, the images merge. Or actually, I guess one's the top half of the image and the other's the bottom half of the image. And once they line up to make a hole, they knew they were lined up correctly. And from there, you'd have the exact distance and the exact heading.
That's pretty much it. And then they just did radar, but that was World War II by that point. But in World War I, it was all optical. Of course, the problem with optical is if you have a bunch of smoke or such like in the way, you know, from battle damage or what have you, or from your own funnels, that can make range tanking a little difficult.
And of course, if you've got rolling seas so that your guns are going up and down, then they're, I assume they probably had a calculation for that too, to tell them when to fire.
Actually, by World War I, they had mechanical means of compensating for that. So, as the ship rolled, your gun stayed steady.
Oh, cool.
But despite that, the way gunnery, naval gunnery is described is, think about it this way. You're moving at 30 miles an hour, and you're trying to hit something that's 20 miles away from you that's also moving at 30 miles an hour, and what might not necessarily be a known direction, and you're doing it optically. So you're basically trying to hit a thimble that's on the horizon, and you're trying to hit it with a bunch of Volkswagens.
Right, and that's why they usually try to fire a bracket and then you know fire for effect once they got the range on them.
Now, despite all these issues, though, the World War I naval fire control is actually reasonably accurate. It actually worked fairly well, as evidenced by, you know, a fair amount of battle damage after Jutland. I've seen pictures of SMS Seydlitz, which is a German battle cruiser, that made it back to port with a hole in the side of it big enough to, you know, drive through. I mean, and there's other pictures of Seydlitz in, you know, steaming back to port after Jutland. And the bow is pretty much, the deck at the bow of the forecastle is pretty much at water level. It had something like 19,000 tons of water in it, I think I read. It was a huge amount of water it had and stayed afloat.
Right. Well, they probably closed all the doors and ran the pumps pretty fast, too.
But one of the things is the Germans engineered their ships for survivability, much more so than the British did. And so the German ships, it took more effort for the Germans to build an individual ship, but they could survive longer. And if you look at Jutland, the British had several battle cruisers just blow up, while the Germans did lose an armored cruiser, but they otherwise didn't lose any major ships.
Well, see, they explained that's what happened to the Hood. Against the Bismarck. See, the Bismarck, or rather the Hood, didn't really have any armor on the deck because they weren't used to having, you know, when that ship was built 20 years before, nobody had a big enough gun to fire a parabolic shot, you know, where it would come down straight in the middle of the deck. So they were reinforced against you know, side hits on the hole in the superstructure, but nothing coming straight down. Of course, you know, that would make them vulnerable to aircraft as well. But, and they talked about how the battle was because, you know, the commander of the Hood, he was where he could shoot at the Bismarck with his front guns. But of course, on your battleship, you've got one or two turrets behind the superstructure, and he was trying to make his turn so that, you know, he could unmask his rear guns as well, whereas the Bismarck was coming perpendicular so to his turn, so they were already firing with all their guns, And but the thing was, the captain of the hood knew, okay, if I get this close, then it's too close for a parabolic shot. And so he, you know, they're saying, he just about made it inside that window. He was making that turn just as the Bismarck got in the lucky shot that blew him up.
Well, the thing with Hood, and Hood suffered from a design flaw that the British battle cruisers that Jutland also suffered from, and that was that you had an open path all the way from the turret down into the ammunition magazine. And so if a turret took a direct hit and something blew up inside of it, that fire got down to the magazine, then your ship is toast. And so that's why you had several, the British have lost several ships to what was essentially a one-hit KO. A lucky hit to the turret, and boom, the ship's gone. The Germans, however, had baffles in their turrets between the interior of the turret and their magazine. So if they took a hit to the turret, yes, that turret was probably out of commission, but the ship wouldn't blow up.
Now, what about the fleet that we lost at Pearl Harbor? Those battleships were fairly old at the time. Did they suffer the same design problems?
Not so much. They just got bombed into submission. It wasn't a case of one lucky hit blowing up the ship. They took a lot of hits.
And I'm always amazed how they put most of them back in the service by then the war in one capacity or another.
Well, American battleships are pretty well built.
And we became quiet. But I think I've got a chat subject anyway, or possibly, if we have gone quiet.
Oh, I wanted to see if we needed to add anything to the show notes, and to do that, I had to figure out where I was versus Zulu time. So I see that Handsome Pirates already made a notation in the show notes on the current topic. Okay, how about one I've been wanting to talk about? Has anybody seen any really good, important movies lately? And I'm not talking about blockbusters where everything blows up, but a movie kind of makes you think.
Yeah, I have actually. So we're not talking blockbusters, we're not talking big effects or anything like that, but this was actually on BBC4 whatever in the UK a few nights ago. I watched it the other night. It was actually an Icelandic film, so it's all in Icelandic. It's subtitled in English, of course, when I watched it. English name was called The Deep, which sounds like a pretty common film, but anyway, it's actually based on a true story about, probably fits in nice with our boat topic in a way, actually. So basically, some guys had gone sailing out on a boat off one of the islands that belongs to Iceland, and of course it sank. And they're in freezing, really cold water. And they all die except for one of them. And he apparently actually swam from where the boat sank back to the islands, following like a seagull in this movie. And it was all like in the 80s as well. This is based on a true story, I said, or inspired by. And the reason he survived was basically because he wasn't just a fat guy, he had some sort of, like, special... There was something a bit different about him, so it was a bit like a dolphin, sort of. So he survived, and he was able to swim in this really cold water for about 6-7 hours. And they got in, and then he knew what he was doing, so in the movie, like, goes up to a house, and he comes in and stuff, and it was just interesting. It makes you think, stuff like that, survival stories.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I assume there probably wasn't a whole lot of dialogue towards the end of the movie then?
Well, they show the actual guy at the end who this has happened to as well, like when you watch the credits, but it was a good film, definitely.
I'm sorry, Gordon.
Sorry, good evening, long time no see, how are we all this evening?
Ahoy, I was hoping you would join us tonight.
Nothing like a warm hand in my entrance, how are we all?
Oh, we were just talking movies when you came in. You probably heard that.
Yeah, I heard the end of that discussion. I don't know what movie it was, but yeah, I heard a bit of that at the end.
Well, I was talking about.
What we're talking about, has anybody seen any movies that really made them think lately? You know, movie you found interesting and it wasn't about, you know, a whole bunch of explosions and stuff.
I've been watching Archer, but I've been watching that specifically to not think.
One that I just watched last night that totally blew my mind was Gone Girl.
Yeah, that is a good one.
What's it about?
It's, how do you explain this? Basically, it's Ben Affleck, his wife goes missing. And it looks like he gets all the press attention, like he's the one that's killed her or whatever. And then as you go through it, turns out it's not quite as simple as that. And Amy isn't dead. She organised her own disappearance. And don't really want to give any spoilers, but Rosalind Pike is amazing. She's absolutely amazing and loathsome at the same time.
Sorry to interrupt, guys. 15 seconds to New Year's.
Yes, in most of Europe, leaving about only the UK, which is at us next.
Happy New Year's, everyone.
Happy New Year to Sweden and, most of the rest of Europe. But we're next.
Well, Happy New Year, y'all.
Yep, Happy New Year.
So what happened to your name, Gordon, your usual name?
That one, basically, I've set the laptop up here and my certificate, my Mumble certificate, is somewhere that I can't be bothered finding right now. I've just set Mumble up at the last minute. I tried to sign in with that one and it says, oh, that's a registered user. Okay, so I'm going to have to go faff around and get this certificate out or, you know, stuff that. I'll just put a different name on.
Yeah, that's why I got an extra sub on this name as well. Basically, I'm not going to mess with that. Well, the certificate's gone. That was on some old laptop or whatever, so, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that I know roughly kind of where it is. I just can't be bothered trying to find it just now. It's not that important.
Right now, my home partition is on its third or fourth laptop. Of course, the downside of this is I've collected a lot of cruft over the years, and at some point, I need to go through and just get rid of a bunch of stuff that, you know, configs to things I haven't used in 5 years.
You know, I would love it as some program. I thought that, you know, you can probably do this in Linux. I just have no idea how to do it. The idea that once you remove a program, for it to be able to say, oh, you've got a settings folder in that inside your home partition. Do you want to remove that as well? Yes or no? But actually, that'd be quite a good idea because I only tried this program and I don't really use it anymore, so that would be a good idea. I'll come back to it later. That would be a great thing. I don't know if you can do it in Linux. You probably can.
I mean, there used to be like for Ubuntu, which I don't really use as such now, but there was apt-get purge, but I think that was more for the files, not the home stuff. But yeah, it would be good if there was like a command or something that just said, I think it's what you're saying, like it would delete your Firefox profile or whatever it is that's in the home folder. The dot folder is what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, dot folders and dot files. The thing is, I mean, it's one thing if the programs are kind enough to put those settings folders inside your home folder, so at least you know kind of where to look. It's either going to be a dot folder inside home, or it's going to be a folder inside .config, so at least you can go and have a look. It's going to be one of the two places. It's just kind of annoying when they decide to put it somewhere else. Or either that, or they decide to call the folder something that you would not connect with the program, like .purple. I mean, what is .purple? Unless you knew that was Pigeon. It's like, what's .purple got to do with anything?
Oh, that's because Pigeon uses libpurple.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, there might be some connection, but surely if the end user's using Pigeon, they're not using something purple. And they look kind of make the connection unless they know that.
See, this is why you should just use .ercy, because the config file is your .ercy config.
You know, in Scottish, that just sounds so, so good. .ercy. I love it, .ercy.
.ercy's great.
Hey, Gordon. I'm Valen Galakek, Chef.
Fuzzy Wuzzy with a beer? Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Right back at you. What was it you just said to me?
Avella Gaelic Exif.
Yeah, happy Easter to you as well. I've no idea what you're saying to me.
Well, I guess not then. So when I was younger, I decided to learn some Gaelic.
Yeah, for all I know, that could be absolutely perfect Gaelic, because I don't understand Gaelic either. So, it could be perfect Gaelic. And my congratulations on your perfect Gaelic.
Oh, I thank you, sir.
Right, so, changing the subject, which I don't mind too much. Yes, a new year nearly. Has anyone had a, like, kind of interesting key other than myself? I've been buying certain devices this year that are... it's actually nice to get something that was crowdfunding as well, because I bought the Remix Mini, which was their, like, crowdfunded Android PC, a company who was apparently started by 3 Google employees as well, and they're Chinese. And they crowdfunded a Remix OS tablet. So Remix OS is basically Android, but it's been modified to be more like a desktop PC. And with an OTG device, you can stick in a mouse and keyboard and things like that, external hard disk and so on. But I received this stuff, no problem. But I'd also crowdfunded another tablet where... I basically got into the mistake of when I couldn't claim it to begin with because of an issue with the code. I got into a mistake, like, oh, you know what? I was not quite sure what this was. I was kind of taking a chance there because it was cheap. But I want to, I think I'm buying Patreon possibly, like, to get sent to these things. And then this guy is trying to offer me a discount, and then I'm like, hang on, I don't actually want to buy this. Really kind of pushed me into buying it. So I basically got one waiting, apparently in Singapore. But on this particular campaign, I don't quite trust it either, because it lacks certain information. And, for example, where is the list of contributors who have paid for Patreon? I don't see it on his website. And so I kind of learnt with crowdfunding to be a little bit careful as well. And what's a bit disappointing as well is that I funded the Yola tablet last December, and now they've been having some investor issues. So I'm really wondering if I'm going to actually get that Yola tablet or not, because some people have had it already, but I have warned many who have not. So there's a bit of fun crowdfunding, I think. It's a bit of a gamble, some people would say, because you're kind of putting your money out something you don't really know what you're going to get in return. But has anyone done it here saying that? Crowdfunded any tech devices or really? And what do you think of crowdfunding in general? That's kind of a question I want to ask now.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, just going on anything that's hardware, like some sort of computer, which a phone is, a tablet is, a Pi is, anything like that, you're always going to be, for the small startup, I mean, Canonical are still quite small in the grand scheme of things, but they're decent size, but they're small in the grand scheme of things, and the problems they're having with the trying to get hardware built to enough numbers to get it cheap enough to make it competitive. When you're doing any kind of crowdfunding with computer hardware, you're always going to be at the mercy, and they'll be much, much lower down the chain than Canonical is. So you're always kind of going on faith that a company, a startup, can get any manufacturers to build 100 devices or 500 devices or whatever, because most of them just won't even look at that. They're looking in the millions of units, which even Canonical couldn't do.
Yeah, so I mean, some of these crowdfunded things, they work out fine. You actually get your things. But as I've learned now as well, is you can get an issue with people who are supposed to be sending your device out, because this other, I mentioned one tablet I got no problem from a Chinese company, so I buy 3 Google employees or whatever it was. I've got their thing from last year, that was a perk. I've got the thing from this year, no problems there. But another one that was small, as I was saying, I basically said to this guy, I'm a bit unsure what I'm buying here, but I was going to buy it because it was this email discussion, and then he kind of wanted to sell me more stuff, and I kind of sent an email and said, yeah, okay, I'll actually buy that. And I thought, hang on a minute, no, I don't want this extra stuff, actually. Tried to get out of it. And about a month later, when he's supposed to be sending out these devices, emails back, and then it's like, no, sorry, I won't send anything out to you at all unless you basically pay up and pay this other stuff. So I paid something already through Indiegogo, and it's just, I've got nothing for that so far. I'm a bit like, do I bother going to Indiegogo and say something, because apparently they don't really help? Or do I, I don't really know, it's like I've either lost £100 and got nothing for it, or I get back to his emails and he probably tries to get more money on me again, and then I have to think, is he actually going to send this thing out? That's the kind of situation I got into. Or because I got into an email discussion, which was a bit silly, but you learn from things like that.
I mean, there's two different issues there. There's one that, even with the best intentions, companies can put together these proposals, and then once they actually get their money and they say, right, okay, let's go to a factory, an owner of a factory, and say, right, can you build these? We've now got the money to pay you. They find it's harder than, even with the best intentions, they find it's harder to get people to even do the stuff for them. But that's a separate, completely separate thing from possibly someone trying to change the rules, and they might be forced to change the rules. Who knows? It might be a scam that you've happened to have been sucked into. Who knows? It's two sort of separate things. I'm just saying it could well be that that it's been harder than they initially thought once they've actually started doing it, and they're trying to find a way around about it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That I've started to think this too, that maybe this one wasn't actually genuine. Maybe it was a scam, because the campaign itself was, it's like you pay this, you get a cheap tablet, you can upgrade, and you get a little bit more. You get a case, you get a storage upgrade, and you basically spend £100. So I thought, okay, it's £100. It's not that much. Do this. But the campaign itself lacked certain details. Some of the web pages were broken. And it also specifically said, for the patron perk, which he was offering to me at a discounted price, he said, like, if that you would then have your name put on his website and your company, but there's no web page of people who are paid patron. Okay, so that made me think, that's a little bit. And then the other thing as well is, in the Google campaign, for the patron perk, it basically said as well, if you buy this, you get a Google Play gift voucher and whatever it was. But then, from my email discussion, I found out that actually, this Google Play gift voucher was basically useless unless you're in Singapore, hence why he's offered me a discounted price, apparently. Because you were basically selling them everywhere else in Singapore. The campaign, lacks certain detail. It wasn't really clear. It's like they're supposed to be running a different operating system slightly, which apparently is only really an app for Android or something. It was all very vague. I found that more from my emails with this person, but it all doesn't seem quite right. So it's like, he's got £100 for Indiegogo. I either just say, right, well, okay, I've lost that £100, or I get back into email discussion or something and I put more money towards it, which is probably a bit silly, really. Or I go to Indiegogo, I don't really know what to do about that one. All I know is it's been a few months now, and yeah.
Right, let me get this straight. So this was supposed to be £100, and in return you're meant to get a tablet, is that right?
Yeah, but so £100. So that's the tablet itself, which was quite cheap. Slight storage upgrade, and a case. So £100. And then he was supposed to send this out to me back in, say, September. But because there was an issue claiming it on through his system, I got into some sort of email discussion with him instead. And then he's trying, and I said, I was going to possibly buy a Patreon, and I was going to buy more stuff, which was a bit silly to do an email discussion. And it so on from there, and then he's trying to offer me Patreon and a discount, and I sort of said yes eventually, and then I tried to get out of it. And then he's basically refusing to send anything out to me at all, including what I'd already paid for. That's the issue. Apparently there's a parcel in Singapore that he does not want to open up and send out with what I paid for, basically.
So What I would look at there is compare the spec of the tablet that you're getting essentially for £100 from a startup, from maybe a 2 or 3 person operation, and think, compare that to a company like Amazon or Google or to a lesser extent Tesco or somebody like that, you know, companies that can get millions and millions and millions of units to bring the price right down in bulk. And compare the price, compare what you're getting for the money, and for me, I'd be looking at that and going, can a one person or even a 2 or 3 person outfit with just a startup and doing 100 units at a time, can they possibly get that kind of value and sell it at that kind of price? Like, really?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that as well. But the only reason I crowdfunded it in the first place, this particular one, was because it was apparently different from your standard Android tablet, basically, and stuff like that. And it was cheap. So, but it's not going to be cheap if I then give them another £220 just so you can send me another 2 of these things, plus my stands, plus whatever else you're trying to send. Then it's not cheap. Then I'm like £320. And I'm not convinced 100% that this person would actually necessarily send that. I mean, probably would do, but like you said, it might be a scam. Like, I was talking to some people at my Linux user group and stuff like this about this one before as well, and the same response was like, actually, this could be a scam. And when you think it through, I guess it could be, and it's just the internet, it's just a crowdfunding site, and it could be pretty much anyone, really. I mean, that's how it works, isn't it, really? Indiegogo, Kickstarter, it can be pretty much anybody on there, really, including a scammer. That's how it works, really, isn't it? I mean, I didn't really think of that before, but now I will.
You know, I'm actually backing my first Kickstarter project here. If I remember correctly, it's a $15 64-bit ARM board. So I figure if it crashes and I'm out $15...
So again, you look because it's cheap, or was that what you're saying as well?
Yeah, it's a cheap ARM 64-bit ARM board.
Yeah, but as somebody from my Linux user group actually said to me when I was saying about this issue, he sort of said, like, oh, but crowdfunding is a bit like giving your money to the bookies. You don't really know what's going to happen to it. And, you know, I don't know, I said to him, like, oh, but what about when it's been all funded and all the rest of it? And he was like, yeah, but then they might get issue with manufacturing, and, you know, that's what Gordon was trying to say here as well. You might end up with the manufacturer issues. There's been another 2 campaigns who are currently delayed because of manufacturing issues, but I'm not too worried about those. But what I don't like is when somebody basically refuses to send what you paid for just because you basically said to have additional stuff and you tried to get out of it. But I suppose it's the instant you can do pretty much whatever you want, really.
I think with Kickstarter, there's a kind of correlation to spam as well. Now, think about it. The reason that spam still exists is because there's always new people coming onto the internet all the time.
All the time.
For all the people who are used to spam, they just go, I'll delete it. Just, I know it's spam. I'm not even going to click on it. There's always somebody new that says, oh, that sounds interesting. I might click on that. And the thing is, I look at the same with crowdfunding. It's still quite a new concept to the mainstream, that so many people on the internet for years, doing email for years, building websites for years, but quite new to the to crowdfunding anything. So they don't necessarily know what they're looking for, how to spot a scam. And let's face it, when there's money, if it's an easy sort of gold pot to put there, honey pot to put there, to take some money in over the course of a month or whatever, all they need to do is, and I think with some of them, they don't get the money unless it is fully funded. So they just set a goal that's going to be easily achievable, and then just keep fobbing people off. When there's money to be made, easy money to be made, and they know the internet is it can be at times a kind of lawless zone. There's different laws in different countries and borderless and all that kind of stuff. Then, hey, it pays. While it pays, people will go there. When there's money to be made, people will go there.
I've had pretty good luck. Somebody mentioned a minute ago 64-bit ARM board. Was that the Remix Mini or the Pine?
That's the Pine. That's the one I'm looking at.
Yeah, I did the Kickstarter for that, and several weeks ago I got my Remix Mini, which is essentially the same processor. I mean, it's really the only difference is that the Remix Mini is sealed up inside a case, and that, you know, I'm sure you could hack it, but by default, Android's the operating system. It's billed as the first Android PC, which really isn't entirely accurate, because I remember, you know, 7-8 years ago, we had a flood of Android laptops, or not laptops. Well, it would be laptops, but you know, like mini books on the market. So, but it, you know, for what it is, what it's supposed to do, I reviewed it a few weeks ago on Linux Lugcast. I'm more than happy with it for the price. I'll probably be the media PC for the bedroom computer once I get it hung up.
Okay, I missed some of Gordon's stuff, not a lot of it, because I was changing room. But yeah, I think you're saying how it could be a lawless place, and yeah. But the Remix Mini, yeah, that's why I crowdfunded. When I said earlier, I crowdfunded one, and I got there was no problems. For this one, I was very happy, actually, because, okay, they'd done one the previous year, the Remix OS tablet, which was a perk. It said you can get that as well, so I thought I could do that. I got but then I was pissed off in the survey about the colour for the tablet, and I hadn't done it in time, and was trying to decide what colour to have. It was a little bit vague. And so I emailed them, and, you know, like, oh, well, I was supposed to fill in this survey via Kickstarter, and I haven't done it, and they just sort of emailed back, and like, oh, just send us all the shipping details and everything, and did that, have my email, some more emails, we're going to ship it out, it got shipped out, very happy, and that was a Chinese company or whatever, started by 3 ex-Google employees, the Remix OS people. Called Jade Tech. Well, there's another Chinese company I dealt with earlier this year, and that was not crowdfunding. That was actually the Meizu for the Ubuntu phone. I was not impressed with them, because I got sent the wrong. I said on the thing, I want the gold coloured phone. I got the silver phone. Okay, it's just a colour, but still. I tried to email them about that, and the response was sort of like, have you got a tracking number? Have you got an order number? The invoice that was sent was pretty much useless, because there wasn't even an order number on it. And, well, they don't really do a Bentley phone anymore anyway. I think they were just trying out to see what would happen and get some more sales, because they've got their own Flyme OS based on Android, and they were Android. And then there's BQ, of course, doing the Bentley phones, but I wasn't that happy with them earlier this year either, for another reason, because I unfortunately one of the first people to get an Ubuntu phone, commercially available Ubuntu phone, but also one of the first people, if not the first, to actually lose the Ubuntu phone, because I'd been travelling in the summer, I'd been over in Sweden, I'd come back from the airport, long journey back, got home about 5 a.m, and, you know, you got your travel tiredness and it falling out on the drive of the house or something silly like that. I didn't know until later. Yep, that's my BQ Ubuntu phone gone. So I thought, okay, I'll try and see if BQ would help. But it was off a shot. I mean, I didn't really think they would help, because they just want your money, like most companies. But I contacted them, and they were like, did you do our insurance thing? Or warranty? And was like, no. But the interesting thing here actually is that if you had gone for the BQ warranty or insurance thing that they try and sell as well, and your phone gets violently stolen, and you got, say, a police report saying that, they'll actually give you a free phone. They'll give you a new phone free of charge.
You know, for all the things you can label at Canonical or Ubuntu, I'm sure that losing your phone isn't one of them. That was going to happen regardless of what kind of phone it was.
May I say that again?
I'm saying, for all the things you can level at Canonical, losing your phone isn't one of them. That would have happened to any phone.
No, it's not Canonical's fault. I'm not saying it was Canonical's or BQ's fault or whatever. I'm just saying that it would be... what I was trying to say basically is if you have lost your phone or whatever, it would be nice if whoever the company or the network helped you out a bit more. But in reality, that barely happens. So, yeah, you basically have to buy it again or just think, okay, I lost that phone, let's get another phone.
Yeah, fair point. I mean, I got a new phone at the start of the month as well, so I'm quite pleased with mine. It's not a Ubuntu phone, though, which I'm also quite pleased with.
So what phone have you got?
The Nexus 6P.
So you're going to put, different operating systems on there, or...?
No, at the moment, I haven't even rooted it yet, let alone ROMed it. I like the stock Android, though, so the only thing I'm looking to do is root it. I'm perfectly happy with it.
Well, we were talking about our crowdfunded projects. I also funded the Mycroft AI, because I know Ryan Sipes from Kansas Linux Fest, but those aren't supposed to be out till spring or summer sometime. And I promised Ryan that sometime this fall I would go back up to Lawrence, Kansas and interview him, because I know where they're prototyping them. We had one of the events at their makerspace. So that's something, I guess it'll have to be a resolution. Yes, Ken, I owe you a show for that. So, I'll be headed back up there hopefully this month, maybe. I'll make time. The other one, I don't know if it's ever going to get here. I funded the Witty board. Now, I would logically be one of the last people to get one from the funding campaign, because it was already fully funded when I got in. They were still selling them through the funding. In fact, the production ones were actually supposed to have more memory, and I was kind of going to wait on them. And then, we had the whole FCC thing come up, and we were wondering if we were going to be able to get single board computers. So I went ahead, pulled the trigger on it. But, as far as the company's communications, it's just strange, because the first set of them that went out, instead of sending every person an individual tracking number, they put them all in a spreadsheet and put everybody's name and the tracking number down on there. And it came out, somebody complained, because you could put in the tracking number and get the address, and then of course the name was in there. So the second batch that came out about 3 weeks later, they said, okay, so we've replaced all the vowels in your name with X's, so that'll that's our security. But still the same thing, everybody in a spreadsheet. And then after that, the last email I've seen with them was like a personal email from the manager of the project saying, hey, everybody has to send me a phone number to my personal email before you can get your Witty board. So I just didn't reply to that. If they're gonna mess around and not send it to me, it just isn't worth it.
I think the issue here isn't crowdfunding. It's about looking at the being a bit more cautious of the individuals or the people behind a specific thing. Like if they've just set the website up just now, if the website's like badly thrown together, is there a reason for that? What kind of background do the people have? You need to kind of do a bit more research before saying, yeah, it's working out, whether you think that they have a realistic plan that they can deliver what they say they're going to deliver, and if they can do it on budget and on time and or something like that. Have they had success before? If they haven't, what was the reasons they didn't have it before? Was it a good idea that just didn't take off? Or you got to do a bit more kind of homework rather than just being dazzled by the product itself and thinking, oh, that product's really cool. It'd be great if it took off.
Well, I've generally been lucky where the crowdfunding, there was actually actual product associated with it. Now, a lot of this stuff, the whole idea of crowdfunding is, hey, give us this money and we'll build this product and you'll be able to buy the product later. And I'm too selfish probably to get in on that. I only do the ones where, you know, I'm actually going to have something I can hold in my hand or a piece of software or whatever. You know, the premium is actually a physical or digital product of some kind. And like I said, I've had, and I'm not saying I won't get the Witty board. I think they are selling them retail now. It's just that mine has never shown up yet.
You know, for some reason, I thought you'd said Mitty board, as in Walter Mitty. And then I was trying to think what Walter Mitty was actually famous for, and it was the fantasist guy. I don't know if there's a connection or whether I'm just making a connection that doesn't exist.
I'm sorry. I'm assuming everybody knows what I'm talking about. Witty board, WITI. It's kind of like a banana pie router board, which I also have here sitting on my desk and finally got working. But it's got a MIPS processor. It's got four radios rather than two, so you can do both 2.4 and 5 gigahertz, you know, both for your own stuff, and then you could have a guest system. So it's mainly oriented at building your own router, running OpenWRT. But it could, you know, it's got a SATA port and a bunch of other connections, so you could turn it in to just about whatever you wanted to. And for sake of argument, what I figured out I was doing wrong on my banana pi board, because everything I'd seen said, you know, okay, then plug it in your network and it'll show up as a new device. And I don't know, I would have thought if I'd plugged it into the WAN port, maybe I was just an idiot plugging it into the LAN. It would have shown up on my router, you know, it would have tried to grab a IP address off my router. Now, the video must, you know, it's also got HDMI, which must be on the OpenWRT downloads. Perhaps that's disabled by default. I believe probably can be enabled. I've seen a lot of these that they say, okay, yeah, once you get into it, then you can change a configuration file in root that'll let it, you know, run the video. So I think definitely, since I can plug a keyboard and a mouse directly into it, I mean, I think that'd be great to have a router that actually you didn't need to have another computer to get into it. But I digress. But I finally figured out that, yeah, I could, if I plugged the LAN port into my laptop, then, you know, and look at where it's getting IP addresses from, then I can browse to a login page. So the distro, the OpenWRT is working, at least the one that I've tried, at least as far as getting to that point. I've, you know, I need to mess with it some more, because apparently I don't have the right password. I think one place I've seen root and root, and that didn't work, and root and blank didn't work, so we'll see. But, you know, yeah, I'll be able to do some experimenting with using a single board computer as my router and getting some more security just beyond the regular firewall installed. So look forward to that coming from me in the next month or so.
You know, you said something there about it's good to have a router that you don't need another computer to access it. Surely, what else would you be doing with that? Because, I mean, you're looking at something that you need a monitor, you need a keyboard and a mouse to power it all up and get into it directly. I mean, for me, a router, isn't a router meant to be something that that you set and forget? You just set it up and just, you don't need a screen, you don't need anything connected to it. It just does what it's meant to do, and you only need to get into it as and when you need to fix something or update something or something like that. I mean, do you really need it? A keyboard and a mouse and a monitor all set up, or plugging it in just for that? I would have thought the easier way would be, you know, just browse to a web page and that's your config screen.
Well, it's not that I would need to, that, you know, but sometimes you hack around on something and you find out it's the computer, you know, it's on the end of the computer you're using to get in rather than the device. So yeah, I think there would be cases that I would like to go directly into the device. It won't be as comfortable. I've got some 20-inch monitors that I got here cheap for around Cyber Monday, and they have HDMI straight in. So I'm thinking, yeah, I go back to the utility room and hang one of these on the wall, and you know, and use it as I need for either this Banana Pi router, or you know, I'm setting up other network monitoring stuff on an RPI that'll probably be headless most of the time that I'll be SSHing into. But you know, sometimes things break and you don't know why, and it might be it you know, I think there might be utility in just being able to get in there on bare metal to see what you're doing. The other thing I wanted to do by setting up my own router is to do some traffic monitoring using something like Snort on the same system. So, I mean, the goal I set for myself early this fall, and it's more education for me than any real utility, but, you know, to set up my home network with the same types of security that somebody who, you know, was a web host or somebody like that would have, you know, to go in with using what tools I can, open source for a more professional level of security than what you just find on a consumer router and plug in, forget it, like you said, Gordon.
You know, an interesting sort of thought occurred to me over. You see at the Linux Action Show a few weeks ago when they were talking about a red flag Linux and all the different things that the North Korean government had done to red flag. Things that it was extra sessions that if you tampered with X or whatever files, it would just go into a reboot cycle and it wouldn't let you tamper with those files. And there's daemons running that are recording everything and redirecting the search results and things like, if you put any documents with certain words in them, it would just delete them from your file system and stuff like that. And I was just thinking, this is the kind of stuff you'd expect from proprietary companies, but this is basically open source being used against the people, being modified by some insane regime and used against the people. That's not right. That's not the spirit of open source. But hey, legally, they ain't doing nothing wrong. As long as they're contributing back, they ain't doing nothing wrong.
Well, one article that I read in for last week's KPO, which hasn't been posted yet, but just seems crazy. Apparently, in China, they've implemented a program so part of your credit score is based on whether you say anything bad about the government on social media. You know, so if you're in China and you have, you know, your Facebook page is all full of pictures of Tiananmen Square or whatever, you ain't going to be able to get a loan for the you know, for your new Toyota or whatever they have.
Yeah, and to think as well, as I say, this is as far as I'm aware, these are kind of built on open source technology. It's just they're being built. And just because it's open source doesn't say anything about the intention or what the software is or how it's used. It's just a shame that it's kind of used against the people like this.
Well, my experience with something like that, and I was never going to use it for anything, you know, sensitive anyway, or have it on when I was doing anything financial, you know, credit card number would be going through. But there were some cheap tablets made for a phone company in Europe, and they eventually sold them, but they were running true Linux. However, it was red flag Linux, the Chinese version of Ubuntu. And of course, these things have been out 2 or 3 years. So when I got it, you know, if you try to do an update, the repositories weren't there anymore. So, and I never could get deep enough into it on a terminal or whatever to change anything. I couldn't edit the app sources to change to a different server. So it was kind of it wasn't a touchscreen interface. It would be like probably what we'd have if Apple had been successful in, you know, using patents to keep anybody else from having a touch screen. It was like two, you know, right and left scroll and an up and down scroll almost. You know, you swipe across a bar on the side of the screen. So not on the screen, but external to the screen. So it was an interesting little device to play with for a while. I didn't spend that much money on it. But on the whole, it was kind of disappointing not being able to make anything useful out of it.
I think the concept that kind of, as a Linux user, that kind of spooked me more than anything else was we're all used to the difference between root and the user. We kind of understand that, and we expect to be root users on our own systems, and that you should be able to delete anything with root. Even if you don't know what you're doing, you end up deleting some system file and your system doesn't work, you should at least be able to do it. And it's just the idea that even as root, there's just some stuff that's kind of at a level above that that you can't even get rid of, you can't even modify, which is really sort of scary.
And I think with this device, I was able to put Bodhi on a USB stick and boot into a live version of Bodhi, because everybody said that's what they were using on it, but I couldn't get in anything that would let me install it over the Red Flag Linux. So that, you know, I was hacking around with that for quite some time trying to make it work. Okay, what has everybody else got for, you know, new devices since last year, you know, outside of crowdfunding? You know, what, did anybody have any cool single board type stuff or anything out of the ordinary that they've picked up?
Yeah, well, I wanted to add two things to the crowdfunding thing earlier, and I do have something else outside crowdfunding that I'll mention as well. So just quickly, also there was this like the chip $9 mini PC thing, and you get like a pocket chip, comes with Debian Linux stick into a TV. Some people have this already. I went until May because I've said to have the additional things. So I think that's going to plan though, that one. I've got that going by the emails I received, so that's nice. And there's also the Arduino Boy, like a Game Boy for gaming. That was a crowdfunded thing. We'll wait until next year again for this thing, but that should be interesting. The Arduino, I don't know if people here do anything with that. And I've also finally bought a Firefox OS phone the other month, and yes, I know that now it's official that Mozilla are giving up on Firefox OS as a phone operating system. I think Panasonic may continue having it on their TVs, but that's about it really. But it's nice to have Firefox OS device at last as well. I got it really cheap on Amazon actually, Amazon UK.
Yeah, funnily enough, I came home and found, sort of looking around, and I suddenly jumped down this rabbit hole of, I was a Torrent Freak, they were saying about the Kindle Fire TV thing with Kodi, and I'm like, oh, that's actually quite a good new solution for $25. That actually sounds quite good. And I just started stumbling down that rabbit hole tonight, and I thought, oh, you know what, I'll just get a drink and come on here for a while. So I might be keeping an eye on one of those. I'll maybe check out and see if it looks quite decent. But that as a TV box looks quite nifty, especially for the price.
You say Amazon, the Amazon one.
Yeah, Amazon Fire TV with Kodi. Apparently, there's a tool to break it and put Kodi on it, because Amazon obviously don't want you putting Kodi on there. But yeah, $25 for that with the remote. And apparently it works rather a treat with Kodi.
Yeah, maybe, but it's just a customised Android interface, I think, really, in Amazon. You get to use their apps.
Well, it is, but that's... what basically, if you read the Torrent Freak article, that Amazon were apparently selling out, and even retailers here like Currys and PC World and that, they were selling out as well. And in the article it says when the reporter went into a local, I think it's Currys in London, the person behind the counter says, oh, are you looking for this for Kodi? And this is like a regular Joe, just average Joe public working in an electronics shop, should never have even heard of Kodi. And then she's unprompted asking, oh, are you looking for this for Kodi? He's like, how do you know about Kodi? Because everyone's buying this all of a sudden for Kodi.
I'll really have to check into that, because that gives them, at least in a way, that gives them a big leg up against, the Chrome thing. I'll think of a minute, because I've got several of those.
Yeah, Chromecast.
Chromecast, yeah, because the old version, the non-5 gigahertz, the 2.4 gigahertz, Black Friday, they were like $20. So I grabbed four of them. Because I'm eventually planning to put TVs almost in every room of the house. The house is wired for it since it's a new house. And shamelessly got some really cheap TVs at the same time. If you put Kodi on it, you can almost get everything in there at once. Because I know, Gordon, you'll be cross with me. I'm doing Amazon Prime, but I'm doing it on my no-name smart TV. And I remember you and Kevy a few months ago, I think, talked about that and said, why would you let something on your network that you have no idea what's going on in there?
Well, I'll say this much. It's your network. It's your network. I had never thought about that, the Fire, or any Amazon products at all. I just thought it was this kind of hokey, kind of locked-down version of Android. I wouldn't touch their tablets for that reason. Might be decent, but the fact that they block off even they don't install the Play Store and just never really occurred to me. Check it out, Torrent Freak. One of the last four or five articles or something on Torrent Freak. It goes into that's where I got it from. Apparently there's this huge rush on everyone's wanting a Fire TV. Amazon have sold out. Everyone's sold out, and it's all because the cat's out of the bag, essentially, and that works a real treat with Kodi. So check it out.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's been loads of adverts for Fire, iOS, this and that, but I pretty much ignore those adverts because I know it's just Amazon's thing with a customized Android. I mean, saying that Remix OS we were talking about earlier, that is, okay, that's a customized Android thing as well, and there's loads of them out, quite a few of them out there now, but at least with Remix, that's something interesting and different. Amazon is just a brand and it's just a big company, and so, yeah, Firefox set Fire TV, but the Fire OS tablet is quite cheap, and my mum kind of needs a tablet, so I don't know, maybe she'll get something like that eventually. What I was going to ask Gordon, though, and everyone else, anyone outside the UK pretty much will probably be like, what are they all talking about? But Gordon, have you heard of the Now TV? Because that's Sky's thing to get people on some of their channels without having a proper Sky subscription, but it could be useful to cut down the Virgin Media costs on some of the TV channels in the UK. But do you know about Now TV at all, Gordon?
I've heard of it. Don't really know that much about it, to be honest. What I've seen, not sure that I'm impressed, but hey, I don't really know that much about it, so.
Yeah, but they give you, it's got the iPlayer, it's got ITV usual, but it'll let people have Sky Atlantic and ITV Encore channels that you can't get otherwise. You have to have Skype already, so that's probably the main selling point there. But it's also really, the Now TV box is a modified, what's called Roku, whatever it's called, box, which of course does then not allow access to Netflix, even though the actual Roku box would be able to, because all about selling Sky movies, of course, as well, and Sky Sports. But yeah, Sky Atlantic, it's just a bit annoying, really, that a lot of all the HBO shows in the UK are on Sky Atlantic, and that's tied to Sky, so anybody else, any other TV provider cannot have that. I don't watch as much TV as I used to anyway, personally.
Yeah, all these things. A pity that they have to keep sort of building their own sandcastles rather than just building one bigger thing and just letting people run Netflix on whatever. I mean, who cares if you if you've got a Netflix subscription, watch it. Who cares if it's on someone else's box? Amazon should be the same, so they really should all be that. But that's it's business, I guess. But yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of these things, it's not so much what services they're on. It's like how much of something that you watch. If some service has the programs that you really enjoy, then it's sometimes a lot more worth paying for that, you know, rather than having loads of channels of stuff that you don't really watch.
Well, yeah, but they, well, that's Game of Thrones on Sky Atlantic. Yeah, well, I should probably add here that all the Now TV channels they promote on their thing are in standard definition, and apparently it can be a bit bad picture in general because it's all done through the internet, but it is an option to avoid some of the like Virgin Media costs, and it's a shame really that Virgin Media are not doing more deals and trying to get more channels and all the rest of it, because they are quite big, but that's just how it is, I suppose.
You know, a show I discovered a couple of months ago, and I absolutely love it, but I've now got to the end of it, and they're not making it anymore, is The Newsroom.
What was that about?
It's Do You Like The Best Wing?
Yeah, I've heard that's good.
Yeah, well, basically, The Best Wing is Aaron Sorkin's presidential thing that's set in the White House, but he's got another show. We had another show. It's now finished, sadly. And I discovered it, unbeknownst to me, it was already finished by the time I discovered it. And there's only like 2.5 seasons, and it's fantastic. It's called The Newsroom by Aaron Sorkin. It's basically it's set in a like a kind of Fox News or a CNN kind of newsroom where they're trying to figure out what the source is and trying to do they have confirmation, and they're trying to get interviews and trying to follow things up, and then having live on-air sections, and he keeps cutting back and forth. Right, and we're coming back for adverts, and 3, 2, 1, and he's back in, and they've got the kind of the scenes where the hosts are kind of talking to their earpieces and talking to the producers. You've got all that kind of drama going on, and then sort of talking there, and the guests are there, and then the lights come up, and they're back for advert break, and it's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic.
Well, that's my trouble now that we're in the so-called mid-season hiatus. That's another pet peeve for me. I think actually it was Babylon 5 that started doing that. Just, you know, they're blaming on, well, it's a sci-fi show. It takes too long to make them. So they would be, you know, they'd take off in the middle once they got away with it. Now every show does it. And we wind up with these 10 episode seasons. But I'm not bitter. But yeah, this is where I get stuck. I find a show like that that's already over, and then I binge watch it, and I don't sleep for 3 nights. I did that the other day with the Border, the one. It's the Mexican Texas border one, not the one set in Europe that isn't captioned, so I can't understand it anyway. I didn't realize there were two of them, but essentially one, the one between U.S. and Mexico, I think is the it you know was based on the European one.
Yeah, I found with The Newsroom, I watched, it was on Sky Atlantic, by the way. If you've got Sky Atlantic, you'll find it on that. And I watched, it was just on a whim, I thought, I'll try that first episode. And it was just the speech he gave right at the start, like that opening thing, it just grabbed me. I thought, this is exactly my type of thing. And then I looked and thought, oh, wait a minute, there's only 3 seasons. And then like into the second season, halfway through the second one, I'm going, right, I better slow down here, because I really better slow down because there is only 3 seasons. And then unbeknownst to me, I got told that, actually, they only made 3, and then they quit. I was like, you're kidding me. I was like, okay, I'll need to spin this out. And then I realised when I got to start of season 3, there's only like 6 episodes that was cancelled halfway through the third season. It's like, no, please no. This isn't fair. Anyway, on that note, I'm going to go and top up before the bells.
Well, I've noticed recently, I didn't know you could do this. I actually haven't tried. The Raspberry Pi that's attached to the big TV, now usually I use it just in computer mode in Fedora, but it's also got OpenElect, and when I boot into that, And the only reason I did that was to catch up on the sci-fi stuff. I found out I could watch The Expanse through Kodi. You know, OpenElec is a distro for the Pi that runs Kodi directly. And The Expanse is great. I've watched all those so far. Plus, Childhood's End wasn't so bad. I mean, well, no, it was good. It's not The Expanse, but it was good. It was good. Mini series. So it's got a beginning and an end. Just 3 episodes. So, but I noticed having that up and running on my network, when I go in my Chromecast app on my Android stuff, I can actually cast to Kodi, which I didn't realize. Now, I've not tried it yet, but that's an option. So I guess you could, you know, you could do Chromecast stuff without having owned a Chromecast. And once again, 5150's killed the podcast. Seb, where are we? No, I guess we're coming up on midnight UTC, aren't we?
I'm guessing by the fireworks, the bells must have opened.
Okay, yeah, I just realized I'm UTC minus 6 at 6 o'clock here, so yes. To answer my own question, we are at midnight in Great Britain.
Oh, yes. Well, unless someone set the fireworks off a bit early. But I assume it's midnight here, yes. You know, I start to look at TV shows now with the idea of how much time am I going to invest in this if I happen to like it? Because if you're coming into a show really late on in this run, that's a lot of hours. I mean, I've heard that Mad Men is fantastic, and I think there's like 7 seasons of that now. So I watched like the first one and I thought, oh, that's okay, it's not too bad, but you're talking like 24 episodes in a season times 7. That's a long, long time to invest in a show, especially an hour long. That's a long, long time.
Yeah, that's why I haven't started on something like Sons of Anarchy yet, which I do have all the episodes available to me.
You just gotta binge watch it like a pro.
Yeah, I do that. I won't sleep again till the end of the month.
Yeah, for me, I think it takes a special kind of show that I could binge watch, because usually I'll get like 2 episodes in and then thinking, maybe I could take a break, go and do something else, watch something else, just whatever, and then maybe get back to it later on, watch a third episode later on in the day. I think the only one that I found that I could sit and watch one episode after the other was The Newsroom. And then it occurred to me that there's only 3 seasons and I've got to pace myself. And then it was like, so I have to force it and say, right, I want to watch it, I do, but I need to spread this out. So that's the only one I've found that I could actually binge watch.
Well, that's the problem when you have a too short of a series. Only 3 series is not enough for binge watching. If you got 7 seasons, that's pretty good.
Well, yeah, then of course I'm looking at that 7 seasons and thinking, you know what, is it worth even starting with that? Because that's going to take a long time. Yeah, maybe I won't. Maybe I'll just watch something else first and then maybe get around to that later on. Maybe not, because it's just an awfully big investment.
Well, yeah, if it's a good series.
I've been trying to figure out if I can later this spring just get Netflix for a month and get all the Marvel stuff. You know, the two seasons of Daredevil and then their new one and get out.
Oh, I've been watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. as well. That's really good as well.
Yeah, I've been watching that this season. It used to conflict with something. Well, right now conflicts don't matter to me. I don't have an over-the-air antenna yet, and I just watch everything off Hulu when I want to watch it. So, but yeah, at first it was like, yeah, I'd rather watch what was on the other channel. I think this last season hasn't been bad. Of course, I'm a little lost with this Inhuman and what the heck all that's about. So I'll probably have to go back and watch the previous years to get caught up.
I'm only working my way through that. I'm only at the start of season 2, I think. Or is it? Am I still in season 1? I might be still in season 1. I think I've started season 2. And then I got sidetracked. I think it was at that point that I might have inadvertently discovered the heroine known as The Newsroom, And then everything else got thrown to the side. So it's been a while.
Of course, you know, in February, there's another DC series coming out from the same people that do Arrow and Flash. It's more like a Justice League thing. It's going to have Hawkman and Hawkwoman and what is it, the Firestorm from Flash and the Atom. And man, I don't remember the Atom having like an flying exosuit. I don't remember the Atom ever flying in my day. And a couple other heroes that they're going to throw in, like Justice League second string type stuff. So that may be interesting coming out. And, you know, I think the whole thing is somehow tied into Supergirl, even though it's a different network. I think some of the same people are involved.
Let's face it, Marvel have hit upon a very, very rich vein of gold. They can effectively print money at this point with TV shows and movies and everything tying in together. And you've got to admire them from a whole organisational thing. It's tying all these movies in together in different ways and linking characters in and developing characters in one that appear in others, and then they get developed in little subplots and TV series. You've got to admire them for that. But at this point, Marvel looks like they can do no wrong. They can just print money.
The problem is if you miss a movie or a series, you're pretty much lost.
Yeah, I rented Ant-Man just the other day. It may be, in my opinion, the best one so far. But, man, the trailers for Deadpool look like it's just so far and beyond any of them. Though I guess it's weird. Deadpool's more of an X-Men tie-in, I guess, than an Avengers tie-in.
I tell you, I was so impressed with Ant-Man. Ant-Man was fantastic. It's just, I think, the idea that the hero story, or the kind of the origin story, you always expect it to be I have no idea who all these people are. I'm not really interested in comics. I don't know Marvel. I don't know DC, and none of that. I don't have any baggage when it comes to that. I'm just looking at these as kind of fun action movies, essentially. So I had no idea what Ant-Man was or what it was about. Just went completely fresh, and I just love the idea that the main character in it, well, he wasn't the guy that invented the suit. Fantastic, it's someone else. I just thought that was an amazing twist, but that could have been something that was always Ant-Man anyway, or instead of just the movie's reboot spin or whatever, I don't know, but I thought that was genius.
Oh yeah, I really like that aspect.
I came from the same point. I had no idea about Ant-Man before this movie. I didn't know what to expect, but yeah, it's a great movie.
Yeah, I was real familiar, of course, with the Atom from DC. I was more, growing up, I followed both, but I was more a DC fan than a Marvel fan. And you're right, I'd never heard of Ant-Man. You go around tilts and say that. They say, well, what do you know? Those guys are comic book nuts. They know all of these. But yeah, I liked that. I knew that Harry, you know, well, I mean, after I knew who Ant-Man was and looked up, I knew Harry Pym was supposed to be the original Ant-Man, and taking that in that, you know, he was secret stealth Ant-Man for the government that had never been revealed. And then, you know,
Harry Pym's the background. He's the backstory rather than the main story.
And he's sort of a Tony Stark rival in a way. So, or not Tony Stark, but Tony Stark's dad. Of course we've got Agent Carter starting again the end of the month.
The other kind of oddball one I'd never heard of either, and I went completely fresh to it, was Guardians of the Galaxy. Which I thought was it was insane enough to be just like, what is going on here? But it's entertaining. You've got to hand it to them. It's definitely entertaining.
Yeah, that's kind of a back burner one, or, you know, one of the lesser known comics, but I guess they do have an Avengers tie-in. And see, I didn't realize till after it, the enemy in Guardians of the Galaxy was the same one as in the first Avengers movie.
More like the boss at the end.
Yeah, I think you've got to hand it to them. It's they've managed to create something that works for people like me who don't know any of the background. It's stuff that kind of it's satisfying enough, entertaining enough, just on its own right without needing to know any of the background, anything like that. But I don't know how accurate they all are to for people who do know the background, how much they've changed for the movies, because they've got to do something surely that are different, because the whole point is like keep them guessing. If people already know, if the fans, a lot of the fans, not me, a lot of the fans, if they know what the stories are, then they know what's going to be in the movie, because you know it's or this happens to this character and whatever. I mean, yeah, you've got to hand it to them, really.
It's all about reboots now.
Yeah, and the way I understand it, it's different enough than the comic books that it's not just, you know, everybody sees everything coming that's a comics fan. See, the majority of the comics I consumed growing up, I didn't buy new comics. I went to the flea market and bought used comics that were like from the 50s and the 60s. And so, you know, not only were they 50 pages long sometimes, but they were each a self-contained story, you know, so you didn't have to get the next episode to, you know, the next one in series to, you know, you weren't missing anything. And it got, you know, when it got to the point where you had to, the only ones that were there, ones you had to subscribe to stick with the story, I quit following comic books. So that's why anything that's happened since about 1970 in comics, I'm completely ignorant of. I'm sorry, I guess we've been talking so much we haven't allowed 2D to jump in. He's making a comment in the show notes, so please, 2D, jump on in.
Hi, guys. I'm happy listening, though. I just realized I forgot to introduce myself earlier at, well, it was midnight here, anyway.
So where is here?
Oh, it's in Sweden.
Ah, right. So, yeah, that's now, what, you're now 20 past one, quarter past one, maybe?
Yeah, that's about it.
Well, belated Happy New Year.
What?
I'm saying belated Happy New Year from like an hour and 15 minutes ago.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, I think with the comics, the only ones that I've, I don't know, I guess, I started trying to get into the Star Wars ones. Not because they were comics, but because they were Star Wars ones, and I love all the expanded universe stuff. But I don't know, even with the content that I was all into, comics have never really been my thing. I don't know why. It's just I don't think the medium really worked for me.
Well, fortunately, they were, you know, popular enough in our youth to provide fodder for, you know, great TV and movies. I'm not sure I would include most of the DC stuff as in great movies. It seems like DC's doing really well on TV, and Marvel's really kicking butt in both places.
I can barely tell DC and Marvel apart.
Yeah, Marvel's the stuff that, I mean, I can't tell them apart either, other than the fact that Marvel seems to have Marvel seems to have its stuff together. They seem to be the ones with the big master plan, the ones that have thought everything out, and they've got all these like 12 movies ahead all planned out, and they all interlink with each other, and there's all these little references to different things, and just cross-references, and characters that appear in different places, and they seem to be very, very well. It's like they've got one very, very good team that's directing everything and keeping everything together as a kind of symphony. Whereas from what I can see, DC seem to be, well, I don't know. I mean, for me, the Batman, the Dark Knight trilogy was the only decent thing that I can think of. But that was like three movies that were handed to Chris Nolan, and he's done a fantastic job. But other than that, it's kind of hit and miss.
I think that's true, actually. Marvel does have a team. A big one.
Yeah, I was amazed at my, you know, I thought the original movie, when they cast Michael Keaton, you know, I said, Michael Keaton, are they nuts? And I thought he and Jack Nicholson just really, of course, Jack Nicholson just, you know, tore up the shrubbery during that whole movie. And that, but that was definitely the best of the, you know, the original movies, and they kept getting progressively worse. And then the second series, that's not too bad. I'm just, I don't know about this whole premise of Batman versus Superman, because in the comic books, they, you know, maybe they're not in the, anymore in the New 52 or whatever it is, or whatever the retcon thing is. But I mean, you know, throughout my childhood, you know, Batman and Superman were like the best buddies always in superheroes. So it's kind of hard to swallow, you know. Okay, the first movie with both of them in it, they're bitter enemies.
There's one of the animated Batman movies that has them like as a lot older, like Bruce Wayne or Batman is in his maybe in his 60s, something like that. And he's, as far as I remember, it's been a while, but as far as I remember, it's the idea that he's essentially given up on Gotham and he's went into retirement. He's just a private citizen. He no longer wears the suit anymore, and Gotham's just went to hell. And then when he comes back, essentially, he becomes the kind of the vigilante, and he's too dangerous to stop. And something like Superman is essentially sent to stop him, to go against him by the government or whatever, something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was, but there is one of the animated shows, the animated movies, that's where that is the premise.
They're building up to something like that for Marvel stuff.
Yeah, I think DC are looking at Marvel's success and thinking they're onto something. They've tapped into a well of like flowing gold. We need to do that with our properties, but they don't seem to know where to start. They've got all this stuff, but they just can't seem to quite get a handle on where to start to start doing it. I don't know. Maybe if they were smart, they'd go in and just headhunt all the top Marvel people and just bring the whole team across en masse. Maybe they might have a chance then.
Yeah, they should have coordinated from the beginning. I think Marvel had a much better plan going out making movies.
Well, I think with Marvel, as soon as they realised that, was it Iron Man maybe was the first one? And they realised, hey, we've got the technology here, we can do all the effects that we want to do. We can attract the right calibre of actors to do it, that we could actually turn something, we could actually start planning with this. As far as I was aware, I could be wrong, but as far as I was aware, Marvel didn't start with this big, huge plan. They only realised that after they struck gold with Iron Man, that hey, they should really take advantage of that and turn it into something.
Yeah, but they still owned everything, so they could make that plan once they had struck gold. I think the others just sold everything out to all kinds of places.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. They still had to do it. But then again, you look at why haven't DC done the same? You could argue the same with them. Or have they not had anything that's considered as in the same sort of calibre as Iron Man? I mean, for me, the Batman, the Dark Knight trilogy was absolutely phenomenal. But that came a good bit later on.
Okay, it's 2016 and the world is still here. Happy New Year, Gordon. And, yeah.
Bad news, Bob. The world is not here. We're all in the afterlife. The world indeed exploded. You just missed it. Tell you. You forget your rain heater if it wasn't screwed on.
Yeah, the world is faded with too many fireworks.
Yeah, I love a good joke. You can always tell it's a good joke when it's met by silence. That's always my sign of approval. An approving audience.
Laughing too hard to find my key.
See, that's it. There's a man that gets it.
Exactly.
So I'm guessing I've missed the whole, I'm guessing some point someone's been talking about the new Star Wars movie.
No,
I haven't seen it yet. I think that's still off limits.
Same here.
I have seen it.
I mean, other than in general, a lot of people said it's very, very derivative of the New Hope, or Episode 4, whatever, or the original first movie and the prequels never happened, whatever you want to say. But I've heard some people say they really liked it, and there's some other cynical people saying all you got to do is you're better off going back and watching the first movie because it's the same thing. So I'm sure I'll go see it this weekend now. I usually don't see. And if they have screwed it up, then it's their own fault, because I won't watch the next two until they come out on red box.
Well, people wanted the first movies again.
Yeah, I haven't seen it myself yet, but I have read the book. And yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm guessing it's too new, so obviously I don't want any kind of spoilers or anything like that. But I'm looking at it from, or I was reading the book from the perspective of, I've spent 25 years reading Star Wars books, and my brain is automatically in the mode of, how does this fit into the wider kind of expanded universe kind of tapestry? But this time round, reading it was a really, really surreal experience. It's like it's Star Wars, but it's a completely different thing. It's good, I think, but it's different. It's the sort of the backstory, how they got to there, and how the characters have developed into that, and how the situation is the way it is, and a lot of these new characters and new planets and new. It's just very strange. It's very, very strange, but it's like the start of something new. And so far, from judging just by the book, it's. I'm guessing it's probably going to be quite good. I'm certainly curious and interested. It's got me interested for what they're doing. I've got a bit of faith in what Disney are doing with it. It's interesting.
I haven't seen any of the old Star Wars films for years, so going off to see the new one was good. And I haven't read any of the books. I do remember seeing a thing on the BBC, one of these film review shows, and somebody basically said how he grew up with all the Star Wars, of course, and he was never really that into it, but he never really got into it. But then with this new one, he got into it because it basically, yeah, I mean, definitely it does cater for the old Star Wars fans as well as the newer generation, so it seems to cater for both mostly, and it's going to be very successful for that reason. And yeah, there's a lot of merchandise and things out there. Apparently they make a lot more out of the merchandise actually than they do on the movie itself in the cinema.
Yeah, that's always going to be the case. This is one thing that I now understand. See, as soon as I heard Harrison Ford had signed on, I thought, well, it must be a fantastic script, because he was always the one that said, I ain't doing Han Solo again. The others were sort of saying, well, if Harrison does it, we can come back. And he was just always the one that was holding out. So I figured it must be something really, really fantastic if Harrison Ford was signing on for it. And now that I've read the book, obviously I've not seen the movie, I now know why Harrison Ford has signed on for it. But if I said that, it would be a spoiler.
Well, you basically spoiled it for anybody who didn't know. But Harrison Ford has a role in it, okay. And all I'm going to say is it's quite a good role in that film as well.
Well, come on, in fairness, you see the trailer, him and Chewie, we're home Chewie, you know, they're in the trailer, so you know he's in it.
Well, yeah.
It seems to be more of a narrator, though.
I guess I'm going to say one more thing. Well, it shouldn't really spoil us, so all I'm going to say is, yeah, it should leave you to want more and see another one when you've seen this one at the end, because how it ends as well.
Yeah, I would agree with that by the book as well. I would agree with that. Just for me, it was one of these kind of strange things of everything was different. It's Star Wars, but it's different. It's like they've taken the events of the original trilogy and said, right, where can we go with this? Just let's throw everything out the window. Where can we go with this? Imagine 30 years down the line, what happens, you know? And it's just something that they went off in some interesting directions in some places, but some of it does feel derivative, I guess, maybe. But you can see it being tying in, like giving little nods to different parts in the other movies. Whether that's a kind of homage, I'm not sure. Whether it's derivative, I guess that's on one person's opinion, I don't know. But yeah, I would agree with that. It does, with the end of the story, they're definitely setting it up for more movies, and you do kind of know where it's going to go at that point.
There are definitely differences in this Star Wars, but I mean, it's also made by a different company, but that's a side thing. But it does, I mean, like I said, I haven't really seen any old ones for years anyway, but it does probably go quite nicely after the first six. It's like a seventh movie. It really is. There are a lot of similarities to the old ones, sure, but there are also quite a few differences, so that's why it ends up catering for most people who watch, I think, as well, so that's fine.
Well, I like the idea that George Lucas isn't impressed, and he, when he sold LucasArts, when he sold the franchise to Disney, they basically said, "Nah, I'm having nothing to do with movies," and all of a sudden that meant, oh, these could actually be really good then. If George Lucas isn't allowed anywhere near them, these could be really good. And he doesn't like the way that various things have been done in The Force Awakens. And I'm like, well, okay, that could be a good thing that he doesn't like it. That could be a thumbs up for me.
Well, again, I don't like that they threw out the expanded universe. I can see why. Essentially, they're just too lazy to sit down and read the books. Maybe they thought the books painted them in too deep of a corner, but you know, I would think surely they could have come up with something compatible. I think they're just too lazy to do it. I mean, they wouldn't have to read the books. They just have to go to convention and find a couple fanboys, and I'm sure there are people at conventions that can give you the whole history of the expanded universe and acted as a technical advisor. So, no, you can't do that because, you know, this happened in this book and this yeah. character is here.
Yeah, I tried. They just refused my offer. Honestly, I tried. I mean, as you say, when I initially read that they'd thrown out all the expanded universe, I was a bit gutted because there's a lot of good stuff in there. Well, there's a lot of some dross as well, but there's a lot of really good stuff in there. But I can understand why. Thing is, this time round, they've done some things that are kind of similar-ish to the expanded universe. So that was another thing that I'm watching what I say in case I give spoilers, but that's something that there was similar enough to the old expanded universe, but they've done it this time round, so that's going to take a bit of getting your head round as well.
Well, I mean, the one thing I was just really impressed with the expanded universe because it seemed like there was never a contradiction. You know, of any of the sci-fi universes, they had their stuff together, even to the point, and I've said this before, you've heard me said it, between the first two movies, there were, you know, some prequel books with Han Solo and Chewbacca meant for junior high kids, and I was in junior high at the time. Used to have these book club things where you'd order paperbacks every month. So I got all of these. And there were about three books written at the time. And like I said, this is right after the first movie. And in the book, they have Han Solo defending sort of this frontier outpost, you know, still being the mercenary soldier for hire sort of deal, or anti-hero kind of, with a heart of gold. But instead of flying the Falcon, they had, you know, this outpost has these Z-22s, which was like the, you know, supposed to be the immediate precursor to the X-Wing, you know, same company.
Is that the
Z-95
Headhunter?
Okay, Thank you, Z-95 Headhunter. You're right, and I don't know if that was something originally in Lucas's notes or whatever, but, you know, 10 years later, 15 years later, the games come out, and you're right, there's the Z-95 Headhunter.
Yeah, that wasn't a Lucas thing. That was done by one of the authors. Was it The Adventures of Han Solo or something like that, is that what they're called?
Wow, you're better up on this than I am.
But as I said, in 25 years, I've read most of the Star Wars Expanded Universe books. Not all of them, but most of them. Multiple times. So my whole headspace when I'm reading a new Star Wars book is, how does it fit into this wider tapestry? So reading one that was official Star Wars, but it's different. It's something different. It's just odd. It's a really odd experience. And knowing it almost reads like fan fiction because of that. It feels like fan fiction because they've taken a completely different line up to that point. And the characters have went in different ways. It just feels very different. But, there's a lot to like in the expanded universe, actually. And the thing is, in the beginning, though, it wasn't that well tied together. But It was only later on that once they realized actually we could make something here, it was only then that they started to get a team together and sort of manage it all and make sure that everything all tied together and everything, nothing contradicted each other and continuity was right and the timelines were right and it was all that. And then once you get a handle on that and that the writers know what they're doing, they know where their limits are, they know what they're actually doing in that, then it is like building another little, each book is like another little section in the huge tapestry.
I just have one question about this new movie. Does it end?
It's like The Dark Tower. Oh, spoiler alert, sorry. As far as I know, Disney are planning for this to be a huge, huge deal. So they have no intention of just stopping at one movie. They're just going to keep pumping movies out now. As long as they're making money, as long as the quality's up to enough that the people that are buying it, that are buying the tickets, as long as they keep going to see it and getting the DVDs and things like that, as long as they keep making their money, they're going to keep pumping this out. It's going to be a machine.
Well, I'm wondering if what 2D means is that it's like the other six movies. There's absolutely no denouement. It's just, and I'm pronouncing that word wrong, I know. You know, it just stops, and you know, you go into the goes right into the music and the weird circle thing that goes into the credits, you know, so that I got, you know, the other six movies, there was no coming down to an end. It just the movie just abruptly stops.
Well, there was Jub Jub. That was kind of an ending.
Yeah, I think with this, even with the original movies, all the threads do all tie in, all the main ones tie in, but there's always background stories. And the background stories, if you read the Expanded Universe, you start to pick out more of those. And even with the Marvel stuff, you've got Agent Carter? Is it Carter in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., where he's in the movies. And then he suddenly appears, he's got his own show, his own TV show, where he is the sort of head of the team. And then Samuel Jackson, Fury, comes in for the odd episode, for the odd scene and things like that. So there's always more stories to be told there, even if they tie in all the major threads to end in like three movies and things like that. But as far as I know, the idea is Disney are looking to turn this into, let's start a Star Wars movie every year or every couple of years for a long, long time to come, yeah, if they can keep making money out of it, because that's what they're all about, is money.
Well, that's
yeah, we didn't mention that.
As long as it's not just a cut, then you know there's going to be a movie starting right after that cut. Maybe let a year or two go between the movies or something?
Well, apparently movie 8 has already been signed on. Apparently it's the guy that was doing the Godzilla movie that he was signed on for movie 8. And I don't know if that's a spin-off with one of the characters or whether that's something that carries on from where The Force Awakens ends. I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of, you can look at individual characters, forget the quality of the movies. You could even look at back at the prequels and say you could do a Yoda spin-off, where it's a single movie about Yoda, or the plans they had for a Boba Fett series, or a movie where Mace Windu is the lead character, or anything like that. If the characters are good, then they can go off on individual stories, or like a Han Solo special, or something like that,
Isn't there going to be a Star Wars TV series this spring or summer? I don't know if it's like, way, way prequel or something, off on the video games, like the role-playing one that they had. But I thought there was supposed to be some sort of Star Wars TV series coming, and not a cartoon, live action.
Yeah, I'd heard that there was meant to be a live action set between episode 3 and 4, and then a while later than that, I didn't hear anything. And then a while later, Rebels appeared, which is not live action, but it is still set between 3 and 4. So maybe they can changed their mind on that and just went with live action, or sorry, went with the cartoon. I don't know.
Well, I used to, you know, I think it's funny, you know, my dad, they had reruns, or well, after the series of Clone Wars, the cartoons on about noon on Sundays, and of course he always wanted to watch football. I said, no, you watch football all day. I'm gonna watch this, then you can watch football. But you know, at first he was like grumbling and all that, but eventually he became a fan, you know, because it did have this story arc and everything, and such an, you know, such incredible animation. Of course, it's all computer generated. You know, just blows away anything else like the cartoons we watched as kids. And, you know, he finally admitted to me, he said, you know, it'd been amazing if we had something like this, you know, when he was a kid. Of course, they didn't even have TV when he was a kid, but, you know, he started really getting into it.
Yeah, I've got to say, I love the Clone Wars cartoon, actually. Some of the acting's a bit hokey, some of the writing's a bit hokey, but overall, I think the Clone Wars cartoon is fantastic. And it took me a while to realise what it is, what the elements are that I like about it. And then part of it, I thought, it's like Jedi Tag Team. See where you get like one episode and it's Anakin and Ahsoka. And then at the end of the episode, they get past their part. And then the cavalry arrives, and the cavalry comes in the form of like Mace Windu. And then he takes the lead for the next episode. And then the cavalry arrives for him to dig him out of a hole. And it turns out to be, you know, Kit Fisto and Yoda or something like that. And it's basically Jedi Tag Team. It's fantastic. The lightsaber stuff is mental as well. It's absolutely mental. Some of the fight sequences, like Sidious against Savage Press and Maul, is just brilliant. Asajj Ventress, her duels are always mental as well, with the dual lightsaber. Right. I mean, as much as they're kind of comedy relief, I also love the battle droids as well. They'd be sarcastic things like, oh, not again, Jedi, not again. It's like, sir, Jedi approaching, oh, I hate this job.
That's one of the good things from the first movies. Well, the prequels. I like those guys, actually.
Yeah, they are. I used to think they were quite annoying. I used to think Ahsoka Tano was annoying as well. And then in both cases, they kind of grew on me. The battle droids, as the season goes on, as the series goes on, the battle droids get funnier and funnier.
Yeah, I mean, the battle droids actually have a lot more personality than R2-D2 and C-3PO. But of course, you know, I guess they probably have less tightened down controls, considering they're actually allowed to shoot people.
Yeah, and they get so short screen time compared to, say, R2, so they have to be more expressive.
Yeah, I think with the technology for the CGI and the storytelling, the computers for the storytelling, the action in the Clone Wars is unbelievably good. Whether it's all the stuff happening in the background, the dogfights, the stuff blowing up in the background, the sort of the Jedi out in the field, and just millions of laser blasts going here, there, and everywhere. And it actually feels like, as the story builds up, it feels like a real, like a war, like a proper war that's spread right across the galaxy as you go from one planet to the next, the next, the next. It just feels like this big, huge thing rather than, I mean, if you just watch the movies, yeah, I mean, the Clone Wars has begun. At the end of episode 2, the Clone Wars has begun. Is it really? It's okay, it's been quite a hefty fight on Geonosis, but really? War? Is it a war? No, not so sure. And then by the start of episode 3, you've got the assault on Coruscant, and it's like, yeah, a big hefty battle over the in the skies over Coruscant, but war? Just with the TV series, you get to see that, yeah, that's a war. There's lots and lots of planets and all sorts of beings in all shapes and sizes are all getting dragged into this, whether they want it or not.
Well, one thing you don't get from the movies that you see in the expanded universe is that, you know, the reason the Empire builds the Death Star is that they are, you know, they're actually spread really, really thin. The you know, the more powerful planets still do have their own navies, you know, and so they're, you know, really the Empire's only kind of keeping control out of all these planets by the skin of their teeth. And that's the first, you know, that's sort of the theme of the first few of the expanded universe books, you know, the ones that are from the perspective of Han and Leia and all that, that, you know, they're the new government, and without all these terror, you know, weapons, that they're having a real time, you know, pulling all these new planets into order.
Well, didn't you see the end of episode 2? The Geonosians were they had the plans for the Death Star. That was right at the end. That was what Poggle the Lesser was actually showing Dooku, was the plans. Like, we need to get out of here, because if the Republic get the plans, well, I'll take them to my master. That's the plans for the Death Star.
A Death Star.
Well, yeah, true enough, a Death Star. Yeah, and then at the end of Revenge of the Sith, Sidious and Tarkin and Vader are looking out of the bridge of the Star Destroyer and onto the very beginning stages of that starting to be built, the Death Star starting to be built.
Yeah, so that's interesting. It takes them, you know, between the prequels and the original, it was supposed to be, you know, 15, 20 years. Well, it'd be Luke's lifetime, so at least, you know, almost 20 years to build the first Death Star, but then they have another one built by the third movie. So they're probably, I guess, building them in parallel, maybe.
Yeah, they must have learned all the quick way to do it for the first time. Reuse all the machinery, all the production lights. Just scale it up and reuse it. We've already designed this, so that's fine. But boss, we need to remember and build a different obvious flaw into it. You know, with the expanded universe, there's a lot of good stuff in there, but there's a lot of sort of not so good. Thing is, I'd always held hope that, I mean, it was never going to happen, really, but that the Darth Kydus thing was going to be turned into something other than just a book. So I think that's a fascinating storyline, is the Jason Solo to Darth Kydus, the rise and fall of Darth Kydus. Which is about the same time, actually, as The Force Awakens, but along a different timeline. But hey, that's not going to happen now.
Yeah, I have far less of encyclopedic knowledge of the expanded universe books, but I much preferred, say, the first few with Grand Admiral Thrawn than the later ones with the Jedi Wonder Kids. Han and Leia's kids.
Yeah, I think it's a different era. I like a lot of these different eras for different reasons. The prequel era was always fascinating because you knew what the build up was going to turn into. It was going to be a war that was coming that was going to engulf the Republic and use that as an excuse to become the Empire, whatever. So you could see all the sort of the big picture stuff that the characters on the ground couldn't see. Like some border dispute somewhere that Anakin and Obi-Wan have got to go to, and they've got no clue who the Separatists are or whether there's a war coming at all. They're only dealing with one of Dooku's like minions, you know. So that's the whole sort of interesting idea that the soldiers are that everyone's rooting for. And what effectively becomes the bad guys, because Sidious flips them round. It's kind of interesting times. It depends on the characters. The post of the Jedi stuff, Han and Leia's kids, that some of that is quite annoying, to be fair. But Darth Kydus, his storyline is utterly brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. It's one of those, I've read most of the books, and the seven or so the nine book series, I think it's The Legacy of the Force, is probably the best Star Wars stuff I have ever read. It's fantastic.
Well, I mean, in a way, you can see in Palpatine's mind, he's the hero because he can look at the Republic and see, you know, there's just way too many moving parts here, and this ain't working. And the only way to hold it together is with an iron fist.
Well, there's actually one book. Have you read Darth Plagueis?
No, I missed that one. I need to get back into actually reading stuff. The only stuff I quote read anymore is audiobooks.
It's one of the Expanded Universe books that I'm the most disappointed that has been swept under the rug because it was so good.
Right. So so you know what I'm going to say then. That's one of those. Darth Plagueis was one that it's very, very rare that you can, that a book can reflect a story, reflect a movie, and reflect what you already think of it, but just completely flip it on its head. Because I went into that thinking, I went into Darth Plagueis thinking, right, this is a guy that gets referenced by Palpatine or by Sidious, it's Sidious's master. Right, okay, I can go with that, and we'll find out where Sidious started, which you do. But the thing that kind of flipped it on its head was the idea that it intersects with episode one, so you see different things from different angles all the way through the build-up to episode one and through episode one, and then you find out that Maul was never a Sith Lord. It was never a Sith, because I always thought there's always one master and one apprentice. Well, Sidious is the master and Maul's the apprentice. Not really. It's actually Sidious was the apprentice all the way through episode one. Plagueis was the master. You just never saw him. And then Maul never was a Sith. And then once you wrap your head around that, you're thinking, whoa, that is mental. That is absolutely, I never saw that coming. And I just realised that I spoiled that. Sorry. It's a fantastic story. But just from that angle, that it kind of completely flipped episode one around and just completely changed it. I thought, oh, that's impressive. That's really impressive.
Well, that's okay. According to Disney, it doesn't exist anymore. So I guess you spoiled nothing.
Well, same yeah. With Star Trek. No spoiling it either. Because everything's new. That's one way to kill a Star Wars conversation.
No, I think you just made it better, actually. That's okay. Well, yeah,
I was going to say, I was wary about what Disney were going to do. I think all this, all the kind of ideas that were planned originally of live action shows and all that kind of stuff, that was all when Lucas still owned it. I think that was when Lucas still owned it. And then when he sold it to Disney, all the stuff that was currently being done, that's in the air. All the stuff that was maybe planned or rumoured to be planned possibly at some point in the future, all that's in the air as well. And essentially it's up to Disney to do whatever they want to do with it. And I did see a lot of grumbling about, oh, Disney, kids stuff. What's a kids? It's a kids show, really. It just so happens that we were all kids when the original ones came out. We've grown into adults, but it's stuck with us. But it's still a kids show. It doesn't change the fact that it's a kids show, really, or a family show. I think from what I've read at The Force Awakens, well, the book anyway, I'm optimistic. I think we're onto something that could actually be really good. But time will tell.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.